Good morning, everyone. I'd like to convene the May 24th, 2016 meeting of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Welcome, everyone. We have a busy agenda this morning. First up is the Task Force on Funding for Fish and Wildlife and Related Outdoor Recreation and Education, House Bill 2402. And like to welcome Commissioner Mark Labhart. Good morning, sir. Welcome to our committee, and thank you so much for your very early appearance here today.
Good morning, Chair. Yeah, it was a beautiful drive over this morning.
Fantastic.
Thank you. For the record, again, I'm Mark Labhart. I have the privilege of being a Tillamook County Commissioner, but I also have the privilege of chairing a legislative task force that you helped put together, both at the House level and the Senate level, on House Bill 2402. And my purpose today is to give you a status report on that. But before I do, I want to blow a little smoke about Beth Petrino. Beth is our staff person that's helping us to facilitate, put together, get meetings scheduled, all those kind of things. I just want to tell you, she's done an outstanding job. So I don't have any bias at all. So it's very true. Beth, thank you for all your help in getting our committee up and running and continue to run very well. So you have a good committee.
Thank you very much. And I think every person on this committee realizes that, recognizes that. And on behalf of the whole committee, Beth, thank you very much.
So if you'll train your eyes over here, this is a very busy slide, and I made it busy on purpose because, as you know, in the committee, ODF&W wears a lot of hats, and their mission is very broad. And so this is just my depiction of some of the things that ODF&W is involved in. Some of those services are funded by Fish and Wildlife license fees. Some of them are funded by federal fees. Some of them are unfunded mandates that ODF&W has to try to find funding for. So House Bill 2402, move to the next slide here, is a task force that you put together. This is one of our meetings. We meet down in room 50 downstairs in the basement. It was established, of course, by the 1517 legislature. We were all appointed by the governor for this committee. And I want to actually go through the members on here because I think it's a fairly diverse group, and it's a fairly interesting group because it's some of the not the usual players that you might see on a task force. And we do have some usual players, though. Senator Chris Edwards, particularly want to compliment Senator Edwards. I think he's made almost every meeting, and legislators, as we all know, are very busy people, and he's made the attempt to make almost every meeting. Senator Doug Whitsitt also has attended almost every meeting. Mr. Krieger has been there, and he has a long drive. He's called in by phone and attended almost every meeting too, and Representative Ken Helm. And then we have the chair of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, Mike Finley, Scott Welch, who is a executive with Columbia Sportswear, Rob Morrison with Leupold and Stevens, Rob Ball from the Nature Conservancy, Paul Donheffer from the Oregon Hunters Association, Carrie Westland, Travel Lane County, Claire Pucci, who's a retired Portland Environmental Services, Kenji Sukahara, Oregon Bicycle Racing Association, Merrill Reddish, retired Portland Audubon, Bruce Taylor, the Oregon Habitat Joint Venture, James Nash, who's a rancher from Northeast Oregon, drives down for our meetings all the way from up in the Joseph area of Northeast Oregon, Tricia Tillman, Multnomah County Health Department, Quita Gonzalez, Center for Biodiversity, Nancy Bales, Gray Family Foundation, myself, and then, of course, Kurt. And then we have usually a fairly good audience of folks that are in the room from various groups and interests that watch us and watch how we work. So our charge from the legislature, we are to do three things. In House Bill 2402, and I'm paraphrasing now, identify and recommend potential alternative and sustainable funding sources for ODF&W. And that's where we're spending the majority of our time right now, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, but that's where we're spending the majority of our time. Develop recommendations on whether adjustments are necessary to ensure that relevant program areas are funded in accordance with the intent of the Act. identify and recommend opportunities to better achieve the mission through leveraging, coordinating, and budgeting funds from alternate and existing sources such as federal funds, license and permits, lottery funds, and mitigation funds. So that's our charge. So how are we going about doing this? We asked the department to provide us with four funding scenarios so that we had an idea of what the dollars we were striving for. We asked them to give us, if we had the status quo of their operations, what kind of budget are we looking at, total dollars, a status quo plus deferred maintenance and unfunded mandates. And unfunded mandates are fairly broad, but deferred maintenance on things like hatcheries and buildings, those kinds of things. Fully implementing the department's mission, and that was a tough one for the department to put together because, as you all know, the department's mission is fairly broad. And so we said, well, do the best job you can of getting us what the dollar amount would be to fully fund the department mission from your perspective. So we had those four or three scenarios. And then the last one was branding and marketing. If we put together a branding and marketing scenario to push ODF&W out into the public more and saying, this is what we're about. This is what our marketing is. This is what our branding is. Give us some funding for that. So then we developed a laundry list of potential funding items, and I was telling Representative Krieger just before the meeting that laundry list was fairly aggressive. We ended up with about 40 items, and they were all over the board. And we asked them, our task force members, to talk to their constituencies and get their own ideas on these broad ideas. And so, I mean, it was all over the board from soup to nuts about ideas. And of course, we had reactions to some of those immediately on some of those. Whoa, wait a minute, you can't do that. But we wanted to have a laundry list to begin to pare those down and work down to what we call the vital few. So I put this together before we had 40 options. So it was 32 when I put this together, and then we got a few more, so it's about 40 now. So the task force, what we're doing now, we've had 5 meetings. We're now working to review each proposal based on a set of criteria that we developed to narrow the recommendations down to the vital few that we think have a chance of passing muster with you all. And that's the tough part. It's going to be passing muster with all of you. So then we're also going to look at breaking into 2 work groups. One is conservation opportunities, and this work group's going to assess how well the funding proposals implement the Oregon conservation strategy. It will also consider the feasibility and implications of shifting some conservation efforts that provide broad public support off of licensed dollars or federal excise tax to alternate funding sources. The group may also consider ways to leverage funds for existing sources and alternate sources to better achieve the conservation mission. Second task force, Connecting Oregonians with Natural Resources in the Outdoors. This group will consider how well alternate funding proposals improve access to and engagement in outdoor recreation and education opportunities. They will assess who they reach, what the gaps are, and what the challenges are and potential opportunities. We may also discuss marketing and outreach ideas, engage diverse communities, partnerships with NGOs, private sector tourism, public health, and other agencies. So, in addition, we're proposing 2 surveys. One is in the process right now, and one we're looking for funding for that from an outside source to put that together. So it hasn't been quite firmed up yet. The first public survey will happen this month. It's essentially asking the public, what is their knowledge and awareness of ODF&W? And if they have the knowledge of ODF&W, what's their attitude or opinion about the agency? So we mentioned scales. The second separate survey will ask the public their opinions on the funding scenarios that the task force has vetted. We think that the second scenario, if it's funded and if we get that, that would help you in your deliberations in the 17th session to say, well, we vetted this with the public, and the public supports this idea, they're neutral on this idea, or they don't like that idea at all. So we thought, besides the task force giving you our educated opinion on these different funding scenarios for long-term sustainable funding for ODFNW, that it would help to say, this is what the public's on a statistically valid survey would provide to you. So, again, we're about halfway through our charge. We're to be done in September, come back to you and report the results in September. We have a group of dedicated and committed folks from all over the state. They're working to address the charge that you gave them. They're working some pretty lengthy meeting hours. Our meetings are usually from 10 to 4. We're meeting once a month. In June, we're going to meet twice a month. We want to produce the best product that we can that will pass muster through the legislative process. So we welcome your input, your guidance, your thoughtful approach on are we headed down the right track. We'll get you that report in September. And I'd like to say that what I've observed, and I'm kind of a, I don't have any dog in the fight with ODFNW. I'm a county commissioner. I'm not a lobbyist either way for ODFNW, other than I support the agency pretty strongly. What I've tried to instill in the task force is that, you know, we have a variety of interest groups that attend our meetings. We have, you know, Oregon Wild, Oregon Hunters Association, Oregon Trout, other groups that may not necessarily agree on how things happen. But to the letter, if you ask them, do you think ODFNW ought to have long-term and sustainable funding? And they will say yes. And then what I say to them is, I say, we have to come together and come up with some long-term sustainable funding, irrespective of what your policy position is, maybe on an issue that ODFNW has. We all agree that ODFNW needs to have sustainable long-term funding, correct? Yes. Now, we need you to come to the table with your constituencies and make sure that that your legislators support long-term sustainable funding. And then if we want to talk about policy issues, that's another discussion for another time. But what we want to do is try to find a system that we can provide that long-term sustainable funding for ODFNW. And we're going to need not only this committee, but we're going to need your colleagues to step up to the plate and help to support this for the long term. And if I can help do that, or members of our committee can help do that, our task force, or if we can have our group in any way make presentations to other lobbyists or visit with other legislators, we'd be glad to do that, because it's going to take a broad-based support, not only with your committee, Chair Witt, and with Senate committee, but with all the other senators and legislators to help to make this go through. We want to, you've given us clear direction. I think, if I recall, the House approved it 58-0. And I think there was only 4 no votes in the Senate when House Bill 2402 passed. So that was pretty strong direction that the legislature gave, that we want you to come up with some good recommendations for us. So we're taking this really serious. We have a group of dedicated folks that are around the table. We have a really good turnout at every meeting, and we're going to try to do the best we can to implement your charge that you gave us. So I'd be glad to answer any questions you have.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for Commissioner Labhart, Chair of the Commission, Vice Chair McLean?
Well, I want to tell you it's a joy to hear your presentation because it's very pragmatic, and it also is very organized, and it truly looks like a complete conversation that includes the public, which I love. And I really think that, you know, I mean, it looked like such a big task when we went through the bill itself, and I feel you've done an admirable job of really getting to the real meat of what we're specifically trying to get out of the task force, which is to really make sure that we've got the right funding, and we've got it at the right time for the right goals. And also, you pointed out that we do have something that everybody can agree on, and that is that we need that funding to do appropriate work across the landscape and also for a variety of different purposes, from education to really looking at the species protection and looking at the opportunities for hunters and all of the different types of activities that you've been talking about. But thank you very much, and I'm excited to look at the list of 40 or 16 or 12 or whatever you think is viable. But again, a good work.
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to apologize to you. I will not be able to make it to the meeting on Thursday. I have to be out of town and, for family situation and other things. But I am also looking forward to the ideas that come out of this task force. It seems almost every day that I'm having a conversation about this, which is, I guess, considered a bit unusual because, as I've said in the past, much of my district, many of the folks in my district are no longer hunters or fishing people, but they are outdoor folks, and they want to know what's going on with that. So I'm looking forward to seeing it, and the list of the committee members is really heartening. So I've been on edge waiting to see what you come up with. So thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Mark, we hear from time to time, or at least I know I do, and I think several of the other committee members do as well, suggestions that we check in with some other states to see some of the innovative ideas that that they've come up with, and I'm wondering if your task force will have an opportunity to check in with any other states.
Chair Witt, no, we didn't check in with anybody. It's all behind the scenes work. So no, in all seriousness, that's exactly what we did. Was, you know, life's too short not to steal good ideas from other people. I mean, that's so immediately we looked at what other states are doing, and in fact there was it's called the Blue Ribbon Task Force. It is a national group that is looking at funding for natural fish and wildlife agencies across the rest of the United States, and thank goodness they have just completed their work, and they have come up with a recommendation to help fund fish and wildlife agencies across the United States with a federal funding source. And so that federal funding source would bring significant dollars to Oregon if it is in fact enacted by Congress. So I can tell you I'm going to strongly support that with my congressional delegation to try to see if we can secure that. And so, but we've also looked at other states to see what they're doing, their uniqueness, different ideas that they might have on how they funded their agency. So we're stealing good ideas from other folks. So
fantastic. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd look into that very closely, because with the federal government, you're going to have strings attached. It seems like every penny that they give you, there's some stipulation. So I don't want to back us into a corner where they're going to end up dictating to us, because of the funding, what we will do in this state.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, good point. We will watch that very closely.
Thank you.
Any further questions or comments? Mark, I want to thank you so very, very much for the contributions that you're making here, and the commitment, time, energy, and effort that you're putting into this. It's an issue that has been around for a considerable amount of time, and if for no other reason, I want to thank you for hopefully reducing my email for probably about 20% with the solutions that you'll be coming up with. So with that, thank you, and best of luck with your final product.
Great, thank you. We'll see you in September.
Thank you so much. All right. With that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on the Task Force on Funding for Fish and Wildlife, and I'm going to open an update on the Clackamas County Forestry Product Cooperative Pilot Program, House Bill 2984. And I'd like to call up, please, Rick Gruen, Parks and Forest Manager for Clackamas County. And if there's anyone else, sir, that you would like to bring up, please feel free. Good morning and welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Chair Witt. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Rick Gruen. I'm Clackamas County Parks and Forest Manager and also Ag and Forest Economic Development Manager.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm Peter Doherty. I'm the Private Forest Division Chief with the Oregon Department of Forestry.
Come.
Do you want to say a few words?
Please decide among yourselves.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you in person with a progress report. This is listed officially as Progress Report 3, but I'm very happy to come down this morning and share with you our progress on this. As you recall, the Clackamas County Forest Products Cooperative Pilot Project, affectionately we call it Urban Lumber to make it much easier to say, was a vision of Representative Parrish and helped lead 2984, and through your support, the passage of that bill that gives us the opportunity to develop an economic development model built around the growing of specialty hardwoods, in particular in non-traditional environments, particularly within urban and incorporated cities, using Clackamas County as a model. And I think Representative Parrish looked at Clackamas County. We manage 3,000 acres of our own county timberlands, and that revenue stream from the county timber helps support my parks program. And I think the vision was, is could we come up with a strategy, a model that would allow municipalities to grow and harvest and market a source of high-value hardwoods that could then provide not only a revenue stream for municipalities, but at the same time be a source of raw material for specialty millworks to thrive and prosper as we move forward. So since the passage of the bill and partnering with Oregon Department of Forestry, the first important thing was to develop a grant that we were able to secure through Oregon Department of Forestry to access the funds. What we've done since then, and that was about November, December, where we completed that, and then our first big task was to put together what we call the Urban Lumber Advisory Committee. Clackamas County has a very formal process. We thought that legitimizing the committee through the county's advisory boards and committee structure was the appropriate way to do it. So we have a set of bylaws. We put together a 13-member committee. A lot of this was spelled out in the bill. It's made up of, it has seats for 8 representatives representing the Nursery Association, Oregon Department of Forestry. We have an ODOT representative. We have the Association of County Representative and the Oregon Nursery Association, Friends of Trees, giving us that expertise on that side. And then the other important part of this is that we also have 7 seats for cities. So right now we have 4 cities represented. We have City of Milwaukee, City of Lake Oswego, City of Canby, and City of West Lynn. And it's very important from that, because the crucial part of this bill was to get the cities engaged with this. While the bill does allow potentially for the pilot to move forward, the absence of the cities signing an MOU and us to develop an MOU that would provide that kind of consistency of management across all cities within a particular county is very important. So We did get the, we have had two meetings now of the Urban Lumber Advisory Committee. The first one earlier this year was to convene everybody, get everybody on board with what the project was all about. And then the second meeting held just recently was to introduce the committee members to our just recently selected consulting team. And that was where we spent much of January and February developing the RFP, going out on the street with it. We're very happy that we selected the primary contractor we selected was Cogan Owens Green out of Portland, being more of the overall project management group that will help us very much with the outreach to the cities. The consortium of partners also include EcoTrust, which through their forestry section will be working with us on the technical assistance piece. How do we enroll trees? How do we geotag them? How do we develop our computer growth modeling system? And then create kind of an interface software for the public to be able to interact with the program. So that'll be their primary role. Then we also have Eco Northwest working with us. Their primary role will be to look at what is the pro forma model, how can this be a self-sustaining project or entity going forward when we come back with a final recommendation. But then also looking at the supply and demand modeling for future demand for specialty hardwoods, and then what is the sufficiency or certainty of supply needed to make this a viable and sustainable enterprise. Then along the way, we'll have some other folks come on board with the consulting team. So that they're just getting started now. The county approved the contract, Clackamas County, we approved that contract in just recently in April. And now they're, I outlined, they're just beginning their research around some of these economic ideas, some of the technical and growth modeling ideas. And what we're preparing for now, and again, I think this is the most important piece, is the outreach to the cities to put together a presentation to the cities within our county to get them to fully understand what this pilot project is and what it isn't. As you recall from when we were going through the discussions of what the bill looked like, there was concerns about cutting mature trees, or were we somehow trying to sidestep around local tree ordinances? What would this look like 40 years from now when these trees that are planted now and planted over the next 40 years, would they still be available for harvest, the next generation? We see situations now where a generation or two ago, there was a great idea. Now the current is, well, can we really cut those trees? So as we recognize this as an economic development strategy, it's very important that we also put into place the tools necessary for the cities to feel good about how this supports perhaps their Tree City USA designation, as well as it's not looking to get around development processes and policies and tree ordinances. So those things we'll be tackling in the next few months as we meet with the cities. We've already had one meeting with what Clackamas County calls its C4, which is the Clackamas County Coordinating Committee that's made up of the cities, the county commissioners, city councilors, and mayors. So they meet together on a quarterly basis, and through Chris Lyons and our Public and Government Affairs, we had a chance to meet with them early on in the process, let them know to expect that we'll be coming to them over the summer. We've hired a project coordinator, and working with Cogan Owens Green, we'll be setting up those outreach meetings and presenting to the cities. Our goal is that when we come back to you in the spring with a recommendation, we'll also be coming back with MOUs signed by each of the cities that would demonstrate their support for the project. At this point, unless you have questions right now, I'll turn it over to Mr. Doherty.
Good morning.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, the Department of Forestry has been really pleased with the working relationship with Clackamas County on this. They've been very proactive. They were, I won't say pounding at our door to receive the grant and develop the grant, but they worked very collaboratively so that we could have fiscal responsibility for the grant and have clear outcomes with this. We're also pleased with the approach of having a project manager and then the not choosing one path, but really exploring the options, particularly around the governance of this option. There were some initial ideas in the bill about having to have antitrust, and they're actually looking at a full suite of governance models around urban and community forestry. I also believe the outreach to the cities is going to be really important, because I do think this can be an asset to Tree City USA. It could actually earn the cities an advanced standing by having a way to, essentially efficiently dispose of trees when they have to dispose of trees. Often right now those trees end up, either in dumps or as chip material, when in fact, if it's thoughtful, perhaps they could recover and help support their Tree City USA. So we've been real pleased, and we're looking forward to further progress on this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
I don't know who can answer this, but everything that you had to say about where you've gone and the first steps, I think, are excellent as far as organization of what you're trying to achieve and then spreading that in good communication with the cities. But one of the things that you just said and that last comment about the idea that we're trying to solve a problem, and that would be trees that are either dangerous or not healthy, and we're trying to make sure that they're going to go to their best and highest use. So what part of your program or what part of the criteria, as you're explaining what the program is and is not to the cities, how do you address that? He connected it to, to Tree USA.
Correct.
And looking for, again, solving for problem trees. But how are you expressing that issue?
Yes, thank you, Representative McLean. I think in a number of different ways. As we approach the cities and we develop our model of management prescriptions, I think the biggest fear was this potentially a taking of mature trees. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think League of Oregon Cities had some concerns. And quite frankly, I support their concerns to that. One of the aspects of the research will be to develop an inventory of standing trees within the urban landscape of Clackamas County to give us and the cities a better understanding of how much is out there to begin with. But specific to your question is, I think if we were thoughtful in the management prescription so that the dead, dying, and diseased trees, which no doubt have to be managed for and come down anyway, I think that's a very easy, low-hanging fruit of the solution. That can we get those trees coming into the co-op or whatever it is, as I think Mr. Doherty reported and some of our advisors, those trees get cut up for firewood or chipped up, and the higher value is lost because the most immediate thing is just cut it up right there. But if we can look at it, some type of criteria and protocol, and I don't think it would cause concerns for arborists or public works folks within the cities to recognize that trees that are dead, dying, diseased have and are going to blow down or need to come down, we see the pathway for that to come in. That might be the first level of connectivity to those trees. Where I think we have to do a good job of explaining the program is, could we work with the city so that some level of mature trees that wouldn't be in conflict with tree ordinances or the Tree City USA designations, maybe there's a cap. And I'm just throwing this out there because right now it's all conceptual. No more than 5% of mature trees could be enrolled in the program. What's really important on the financial and feasibility side is what volume is necessary to be planted and grown so that this program is sustainable down the road. And then how do we get there through the planting of trees. Each year, each city would plant trees. And think of it as a Christmas tree operation that's a seven-year cycle. You know, cities to see some type of sustainable benefit would have to plant, you know, on a 40-year cycle. So every year they plant X number of trees so that 40 years from now, as they start harvesting, it's not a one-and-done harvest, but it's a selective harvest every year. So you have to plant trees every year, much like you do on a Christmas tree rotation. So as we develop these criteria and protocols and present those to the cities, I think capturing those, you know, weakened, diseased, dead and dying would be an easy solution and find that higher and better value for specialty millwork materials. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Gentlemen, I'm curious because I think oftentimes when legislation goes through, we may individually have ideas of what potential benefits of legislation may be, and those may come to fruition or not. And I think, Peter, you had started down the pathway for my question. And I'm wondering what you see is some of the biggest potentials for this pilot, and is it finding a higher value for trees and or logs that would have otherwise, in essence, been disposed of, or is it a commercial venture? Such as you described, Rick, where there's a purposed 40-year rotation. So, is it a combination of both? Does it lean more heavily towards one side or the other? I'm just curious. Where do you see this headed?
You want to take a stab?
I can. The yeah. person you follow.
Yeah.
I think your second answer, Representative Witt and members of the committee. The second answer, I think, is a little bit of both. There's a component there that in underutilized space, there would be an opportunity to grow specialty wood. And so there's that component that would have perhaps an economic development or the opportunity for smaller specialty mills. We've seen some of these specialty mills emerge on their own in Portland and in Springfield, and often their ability to get wood is one of the constraining features. I think there's a secondary benefit with the management of our urban forest, which is always a challenging and seemingly under-resourced opportunity. So I think there's a secondary benefit for our urban and community forestry. Rick mentioned having an inventory of trees, and that is actually one of the criteria for Tree City USA. So there could, you know, the benefit of the urban lumber could help the city with the inventory and tracking of their own trees, and perhaps together they could come up with a better product than individually they could come up with. So I think it is a little bit of both.
Thank you. And again, I recognize that it's early, and you know, there may not be folks in the marketplace who have come to be players yet. But have you heard any interest from any potential specialty mills or that sort of thing in the project as yet?
Yes, and I think just like most natural resource based industries, you know, certainty of supply, consistency of supply is very critical, and to have a focused, targeted effort to grow a source of supply, I think would allow not only the, you know, potentially new businesses to develop, but those businesses to expand. Our county is very proactive in economic development, and the wood products cluster is one of our 11 major traded sectors in the county and the region. And this fits in very nicely with that, as we see already certain mills from outside of the county looking to come into Clackamas County. And I think what helped attract them and even helped affect some recent land use decision was that it was part of our strategic plan in Clackamas County, or what we call, the commissioners call, Performance Clackamas. and looking at, you know, new natural resource-based industries to come into the county. So this is not only, you know, meets a state legislative objective, but it's also very important in our county for meeting our county objective. So I think we'll see both the business expansion and recruitment as a result of this.
Very interesting. Anything further? I just take note. Several decades ago, there used to be enough sawmills within the city limits of Portland that over 5,000 employees were employed in those mills. Yes. In the city. And of course, that all went away, and now perhaps we're coming full circle, certainly not to the level of employment of 5,000 people, but possibly a specialty mill for the benefit of not only a market that's been specifically grown for, but also, as you both pointed out, creating higher value for logs that would have otherwise just been perhaps a total loss.
Thank you, Chairwitt.
So I want to thank you both very, very much for your efforts and appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Clackamas County Forestry Update. And I'm going to open an informational hearing on the Task Force on Independent Scientific Review for Natural Resources. And I'd like to call forward, please, Lori Onan and Lisa Gaines. And anyone else that you would...
Barbara Bond.
And Barbara Bond. Thank you very much. My mistake. Thank you, Barbara.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation today. For the record, I'm Lori Onan. I work in the Natural Resources Office of Governor Brown. And I'm going to kick this off and then turn it over to Barbara Bond, who is the co-chair of the task force, and I really appreciate her being able to be here with us today. What we're going to do is briefly update the progress the task force has made to date, what's next, and have some questions that, you know, we'd like to get any thoughts you have to bring to the task force's next meeting, which is tomorrow. So let's see, here we go. Oh, before I get started, I wanted to say Lisa Gaines is here with the Institute for Natural Resources, and they're staffing the task force very wonderfully, and she's here to answer any questions that you may have. So, okay, so the background, I'm just going to do a brief background on why there is a Senate Bill 202 that was passed by the legislature. And just so you're aware, it did not come through this committee. It went through the Senate Natural Resources and Environment Committee. It went there from to Ways and Means. So it didn't come through a House Policy Committee. The background of it is that, of course, Oregon agencies, boards and commissions make a lot of natural resource policy decisions. And most of those are informed by science. They're obviously informed by other factors as well, but science is a big piece of that. And there's a history in Oregon of having some level of entity, in some cases, that have done science review when those policy decisions are being looked at. And there's some examples on this slide. In 1997, the legislature created the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team, and that was around the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. So the focus of that group was very focused on water and salmon. But they've been around since then and did great work on those issues. Then the Institute for Natural Resources was 2001 legislation that you passed, and they have done some scientific reviews on request of some agencies. And then agencies also from time to time may contract with third parties outside the agency to do science reviews to inform their policymaking. So really what was the discussed in the 2015 session was, this is kind of old. There was a 97 law, a 2001 law. Is it time to look at this again and see what has changed and what Oregon may need going forward? So just really briefly, the key points in the legislation. First of all, it set up a task force. It called for governor's appointments of task force with representation from what you see on the slide there, broad representation. I want to thank all the task force members. We do have members on the task force representing all those sectors, and they're very engaged in the conversation. The task force has been evaluating the need for independent science review for Oregon for natural resources and what benefits there might be from doing that. And then if, in fact, there is seen to be a need and a benefit, they have to make a number of recommendations to you, including what would that look like, what would the process be, how could it be open and open and independent, but also really important, have some public confidence in it, because that's really important, and have better public understanding. And then they would also be making recommendations on what are the types of entities that could do this, knowing that there's a number of groups that have done it, and then is legislative authority needed? So those are kind of some of the key points they're looking at. The law also abolishes the existing independent multidisciplinary science team effective January 2017, and it does, as we'll get into, have recommendations coming to you this September. Before I turn it over to Co-Chair Bond of the task force, I wanted to thank all the task force members, including Barbara. Thank you so much. They've been great work, very engaged, bringing a lot of good thoughts to the conversation. And also thanks to the staff of the Institute for Natural Resources, Lisa Gaines, and also Jeff Behan and Sarah Brennan, who are doing amazing work looking at what other states have done, following up on stakeholder outreach, doing a number of really important work for the task force. So with that, I'll turn it over, and I can run the slides if that's all.
That would be perfect. Thank you
very much.
Good morning, Chair Witt, representatives. Again, I'm Barbara Bond, retired professor of forestry from Oregon State University, where I was the chair of natural resources, Ruth Spaniel chair. It was my aspiration during that period of time for many years to interact with you all, and I'm finally meeting that aspiration after retirement. So, chaka, another goal met in life, and this is really good. And it's my great pleasure to talk with you this morning. Also, it's a great pleasure to be co-chairing this task force. Do you want to just go ahead? This task force was kicked off last fall. The first meeting was a virtual meeting that we held in December of 2015. It was largely organizational, people getting to know each other, but it was a telecommuting kind of meeting. The main meetings that we really started getting into the gist of what was going on in this task force were in March. And then we had one in February and one in March. And then there is a major meeting tomorrow that I'll tell you about in just a minute. And we'll have another meeting that is currently scheduled in July. There is a lot for us to accomplish in a very short amount of time. This is an amazing task force. I think we're up to it, but it may be that we are actually going to need to add another meeting come August, and we'll be determining that very soon. The process has deeply been involved in encouraging public commentary from as many sectors as possible. And the INR, the Institute for Natural Resources at OSU, has been heroically leading that effort. The task force has had its hands full with so many things. It would be unreasonable for the task force members to do this. I am so impressed by the volume. I think as co-chair, my challenge right now is how to help the task force digest the voluminous information from so many different agencies, public groups, tribes, people external to the state of Oregon about what they do other places, and to help the task force digest all this information is going to be a challenge. But again, they're amazing, mature people, and I'm sure they're up to this task. What are we asking? And I'll just go through some of the kinds of things that we have been asking. I say we in the royal sense, really the INR, again, has been doing all of this, but with a lot of direction from the task force members about what kinds of information they wanted, both through interviews as well as through a web-based questionnaire. We've been asking people to respond to us. What are the advantages and disadvantages from their perspective of independent scientific review? I'll get back to this in a moment, but one of the most common questions is, well, what does the task force mean by science, and what do they mean by independent scientific review? So we'll get to that in a moment. From your perspective, what are the needs and benefits from independent scientific reviews. A lot of people already, agencies in particular, have some experience through IMST that they're bringing to this. Others have, as you well know, either biases for and against science as a whole, and so they're bringing that. And so that diversity of opinion is extremely useful to us. Circumstances under which independent scientific review should be used. Should it be a routine? Should it be only in certain circumstances? In what manner would a review be triggered? Does an agency ask for it, for example, or does the legislature request it? So we'll be deliberating that. How an independent scientific review process should be structured. The task force has been talking a lot among themselves about this, and there are a lot of models that we're considering, and we're trying to get as much perspective from the public about that, too. So again, we have a meeting tomorrow. It's going to be an extremely busy meeting. We have a very ambitious agenda. We're going to start out asking the task force to give us initial consensus on whether or not there is a need for ISR, independent scientific review, in the state of Oregon. We have a draft statement. We've been iterating that through an email process, and we're going to briefly discuss that. That determines everything else, obviously. If we decide, no, we don't need it, then that's the end of that process. And so that's going to be the beginning of the meeting. Then we will discuss these working definitions of science, which on the first blush you may think, well, everybody knows what science is. Well, you define it, or you define it, or you define it, and I guarantee you every one of you is going to come up with a different decision and definition. Unless we have some agreement on what we need, it's very difficult to determine what we think a scientific review ought to be. We can share that with you if you're interested in those working definitions. And also a working definition, not a description of the process, but a working definition of what independent scientific review is. We'll be talking in sort of general terms, kind of a brain dump on what kinds of structure and process might be beneficial for the state of Oregon. And again, drawing on a lot of public commentary about what the public in Oregon thinks, but also what's been successful in the state of Washington, how do federal agencies work their scientific review processes. The National Academy of Sciences is another model, so we're looking at those models. And then we'll be looking at potential entities, as Lisa said, what existing entities in the state of Oregon might be available, and what are the criteria for selecting an entity to be leading such an effort. So there are many opportunities still for more input. The task force has one more meeting that's scheduled in Prineville in July, and so we'll be soliciting public comment then. Our meetings always generate a lot of visitors, a lot of people who there's always a place on the agenda, so we get a lot of public commentary. The meetings are scheduled at different places around the state in order, in part, to be getting a diversity of visitors to come in person to those meetings. And we anticipate having an interim draft report between now and the July meeting. After the July meeting, we hope to have a task force. We're aiming to have a draft report that is ready for external review at some point in August, with the goal of having a finished report by the middle of September. Just to summarize the products, the recommendations, that final report will be a set of recommendations that goes to the legislature, that will have a summary of all this input that the INR, again, has helped to generate, and the task force will deliberate. A summary of a very extensive scientific review process of what's in the literature. There's actually a surprising amount, especially in the last 15 years or so, that's been written about scientific review. And we're deliberating that. Summary of mechanisms and structures in the other states that I mentioned to you. And then finally, what does Oregon need? How should it be structured? And what entities might manage that process? again, the final report is due September 15th. Right. Good. I'm glad you put that up, Lori. So this is a snapshot of the website that is available on the INR's website through Oregon State University, specifically for this task force. And there is a listserv that's available that is going out to a very large number of people, and Lori could comment exactly, or Lisa could comment on all the numbers of people, reminding them of the information that's there. Agendas are posted here. All the information that the task force receives are posted here. To keep this as public as possible. And again, the website is listed at the bottom, the URL for that website at the bottom of the page. We have two questions for you. Obviously, if you have questions for us, we'd like to hear them, but questions for you. First, do you have any thoughts about independent scientific review, which I'm so accustomed now to saying ISR, I stumble over that. That we could bring back to the task force. Again, we're meeting tomorrow, and if you have some thoughts on that, we'd sure like to hear them. And would you like us to brief you, more specifically, after we have this interim report, which, again, we're aiming to have a review draft ready in August, giving us just 1 month before we get the final draft. And if you'd like us to come back and do that, we'd like to know that. So I think there's one more slide, Lori, and this is just to remind me to let you know that this is the URL at the bottom of this website. If you'd like more information, there's a tremendous amount of information posted there, and it's available. I'm sure that you have a lot of time on your hands, and you would like to peruse and read everything that's there. Actually, I know you wish you could. I'm sure you wish you could, and you know in advance, and so do I. It's time is tight. But the information is there if you're interested, and we'd be happy to take questions or receive responses to our questions.
Dr. Bond, thank you so very, very much. Certainly appreciate the intense effort that has been made here to survey such a broad cross-section of Oregonians and others who are interested in this and feel that its impacts are critically important. I can't thank you enough. Committee members, typically we wait and have questions after a panel's finished, but I'm almost thinking that in light of the questions that it may be appropriate for us to entertain some questions and comments for Dr. Bond first, and I think Representative Whitsitt was first, followed by Vice Chair Krieger.
Thank you. One thing that I would like to see that I see rarely in this building is utilization of the scientific method in which reproducible empirical data is used to make decisions. And I don't mean once or whatever. I mean multiple times before we make policy decisions on, I call it sort of political instead of empirical data. And I think it's just really, really important that you use the scientific method, the established right. scientific method, before we go off on these policy decisions regarding science. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair, if you recall, you and I were on the Board of Forestry together. I'm trying to think of the year. It's a long time ago. It had to be 99, and we were doing the review of the Northwest Forest Plan for the Class of State Forest and Tillamook.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the multidisciplinary science team was asked to come in and give us some information. And I think you know exactly where I'm going.
I think I do, too.
And one, I won't even tell you who the presenter was, but the contention was that there was science out there to show us that a 200-foot buffer strip was going to give us this much more protection for salmon, water quality, temperature, and all these type of things.
Mm-hmm.
So we requested as a board to receive that information, that science.
Yes.
3 months later, we didn't have it. 6 months later, we didn't have it. About that time, I ended up over here, and Jim Brown, who was the state forester at the time, was in my office. I asked him about it. I says, the reason you didn't receive it, because it doesn't exist. So basically, we were lied to about science, period. Everybody knew it, found out about it. You can imagine what our faith in the multidisciplinary science team is, even to this day. And then, I think it's Dr. Paul Adams.
Mm-hmm.
Had a little thing he gave us through Jim Brown, Science 101, talking about the difficulty that scientists have when they do a research project of keeping their own bias out of it. Now, for the last 15 years, 16 years here, I've seen exactly the same thing regarding hatchery fish, wild fish, and you can believe or not believe it. At the same time, we know we want to protect wild fish and the genetics and the behavior and production. We understand that, but we find that people seem to be one camp or the other. And I have not seen in any discipline the ability of scientists to divorce themselves from their personal opinion. And a lot of that gets stuck in their head when they go to the Oregon State University. The right. Anti-hatchery mentality that has come out of there, this committee has dealt with and seen for the last 4 or 5 years. And finally, we grabbed the thing, the Salmon Research Center, redid the board, funded the research, $1.2 million a biennium, to really get the answers we need so we can produce a fish that's compatible. So that's kind of a lot, but you can see where some of us are going to be. You know, your last bullet point you had, I think, on the paper before this, what is it that Oregon needs to develop? I think that is the big question. But you want to make sure that it's believable and that personal opinion and bias. Otherwise, we can't make proper policy if we don't have the facts.
Okay. Thank you very much, Vice Chair. My name is Lisa Gaines. I direct the Institute for Natural Resources. And I just want a quick response to your question. We absolutely agree with a number of things that you said. One is the issue of bias. And the task force has been thinking about, were we to proceed with independent scientific reviews for the state, how do we address bias and how do we make that very apparent? So that is, and there's many different definitions of bias, not only from scientific discipline, to who people are being paid for, to the accountability, to the articles they might have written, having them not review the articles they have written, etc. There's also a methodology for scientific review that has come out of the medical industry called a systematic evidence review. And it hits at your point about scientist A and scientist C. And looking at science by asking a specific science-related management question. And the idea is filtering through the data and information with criteria about relevance to answering that question so you get the entire range of available science. So we aren't saying, this is what scientist A says, and because it's scientist A and scientist A is wonderful and charismatic and very knowledgeable, that's the only issue. We're saying, here's what scientist A says all the way through scientist C. Here's what the trends that science is saying, and here's how we can help you interpret the trends. And obviously, we cannot make a management decision, but we can at least be able to offer as much of the existing science that currently works. So that is one method that people are trying to look at, bringing this into natural resources management. I know Oregon Department of Forestry has utilized that in the past and currently using it, as well as other countries and states around the world. So thank you.
Please.
I think if everyone's honest, we all have bias. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard sometimes to have an open mind and be willing to accept new information that may cause you to move. You talk about, and even in natural resources, though I've been around it now for 52 years, I find myself moving as I observe over a period of time my tree farm, for instance, things that occur there. With fish issues, with things in the criminal justice system, throwing the key away doesn't do any good. You're better investing in rehabilitation if they meet the criteria, things like that. So we move as legislators, as not that we change our position, you know, to be acceptable to some political group, but we do it because we see that the science or the information warrants us to be over here instead of where we were. So I think all of us are willing to do that, but we hope that scientists can do the same thing.
I'll just be really brief, because I don't want to be brief, and just say what you're bringing up is so near and dear to my heart. I want to take you out for a glass of wine and spend the evening having a philosophical discussion about this.
Have you heard about Krieger's dating service? We do have one.
And anybody else is invited to. We can do that. But as a veteran of the College of Forestry, and I was in that college and through the Owl Wars and the whole shear, believe me, I so completely resonate with everything you're saying. And I think everyone else on the task force does too. It's not... And it's so easy to say, well, let's do science and do a scientific review. We all know this is not easy. We know that's not easy. And it's hard, very, very hard, to be thinking about putting together a bulletproof, well, it can't be bulletproof process. We know that. But we want to, just like maybe the originators of the Constitution, we want to put together the best infrastructure we can to try to prove it as much as we can in advance to the inevitable biases that, as you say, I have them, you have them. Social scientists know we all have them. What we need to do is to create a process that comes to some sort of consensus across biases.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Bond, we are very pleased that we are on your bucket list, but just a piece of advice, don't encourage him. Next, we have Representative Barreto, followed by Representative Esquivel and Vice Chair McLean in the hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One to the representative from Gold Beach. I don't think we're here in this position to market our businesses. So, I would agree with Representative Whitson and Representative Krieger almost verbatim. But one of the things also is I think it's imperative that we have independent review, and because every one of us comes to the table with biases and presuppositions, and that's we end up with a conclusion, you know, that affects. So the other thing is I think the concern that we've all had, and that is how the scientific review affects economically, you know, what we have. And that, I think, is where we're going with this. And so I think we all have just a little bit different view of this delicate balance between our natural resources and our economy and where we've seen it go through the year. So,
Lori.
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, thank you for, and thanks all the members for the comments to date. One thing I did want to say is I think in the course of making the recommendations, it needs to be very, very clear.
Lori, would you please identify yourself?
Oh, thank you. Sorry. For the record, Lori Onan, Office of the Governor. I think it'll be important to be clear that we are talking about a scientific review process, and then there and that is going to inform then what is a policy decision. And policy decisions also have broader input than just science. Science is obviously important. But I think that's sometimes a struggle, I think, in some of these review processes where people want to morph between science and policy. And so there are decision makers who need the science to help them. But so we're talking strictly about the science piece in this.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with my colleagues wholeheartedly, because I think what we need pure science, and that's going to be very difficult because people are people. But more importantly, for us to make the decisions, we need the adequate information. Now, having said that, the one thing that I thought was striking, and this kind of goes along with what we do with our fish and wildlife, I was talking to an individual from Canada, and we were talking about forest fires. Now, that may have nothing to do with the wildlife, but it really does. And I asked him, I said, you guys get fires up there, don't you? And he said, yeah. And he said, I asked then, well, what do you guys do with them? He said, we put them out. Well, we do the same thing. And he said, no, there's a difference. I said, what's the difference? He said, in Canada, we manage our forests by managers. In the United States, it's done by special interest groups. That hit the nail on the head. you want to see a joke, you got to try to fish the Rogue River. And it's all done by special interest groups. You can go so far up the river until you meet such and such, but you can do this, or they have fly fishing only from Shady Cove on up to the dam or to the hatchery a certain time of the year because someone has talked them into believing that fly fishermen, even though they walk in the gravel, have less effect on salmon than a boat going over it. Well, I haven't figured that one out. But anyway, I think that's what my colleagues are getting to, and I thoroughly support their position on it, because if we allow special interest groups to dictate to us on our management, we'll never manage properly.
Vice Chair McLean.
Well, as you can see, we need, you know, hours and hours, and, you know, so your offer to take, you know, a longer conversation, I think, is probably what we all need here. But one of the things that you said that really struck me that I thought was so important, and especially since you have your meeting tomorrow, and that is that no matter what comment you hear up here or what you take away from here, and I'll have a comment to add to that in a minute, it all relies on what you folks do with what is your working definition of an independent science review. And so even though that was on the top of your agenda tomorrow, in my mind, that is probably the most important thing you will do tomorrow. Because we've got to have an understanding of what is a independent science review to have trust in that it truly is a science review, complete, as one of the representatives said, with empirical data, with a scientific method, and that methodology fits for a neutral across bias dialogue. And without that, we can't even start the conversation. We can't use the information because we have to have trust that we believe that your definition is truly valid. So to me, that's the most important thing you'll do tomorrow. So that's the only kernel that I hope you take away from me. I have a comment, but that's the kernel.
Before you say the comment, I do have our working definition of science and our working definition of independent scientific review. I could share them with you if you're interested.
Mm-hmm. I think it's good, but I also think it should be that you should talk about it tomorrow again to make sure that you've reviewed it again.
Since it's my responsibility to have done this and to do this tomorrow, I can assure you that I have spent the last 6 weeks on email receiving, because these are scientists and they wordsmith, probably 3,000 different definitions that we have pared down to what's here. I'm not anticipating a really long discussion tomorrow, but we have been doing exactly what you're recommending. But I'll try to do this briefly. The definition of science is pretty darn quick. We've reduced it from probably something like 200 words to, I'm guessing this is 20. Science is the pursuit and application of knowledge and understanding of the natural and social world following a systematic methodology based on evidence. I want to just add a caveat here. One of the members of our team is a Native American, and he wanted to make sure that our definition wasn't some ivory tower definition that excluded traditional sources of knowledge, as long as it's evidence-based and reproducible, as you said, Representative Whitsett. Here's the definition of independent scientific review. What our definition, the form of it, is it is a set of bullet points as opposed to a strict definition. First bullet, an external assessment of a stated scientific question or issue, which is why we had to define science first, produces unbiased conclusions regarding the current understanding of relevant information, methodology, and assumptions relating to that scientific question or issue, includes, as applicable, an assessment of the risks, costs, as you say, economic costs and benefits of potential alternative decisions or policies. And finally, it's conducted by reviewers who have, for qualities. Little personal stake in the nature of the outcome, can perform the task free of undue influence by others associated with the decision process, have demonstrable competence in the subject as evidenced by formal training and or experience, and should be required to disclose any potential personal stake or conflict of interest with respect to the stated question or issue. That's what we're taking in tomorrow. We can share copies of this, and it's also on the INR website. If any of you would like to share input, we're open to it.
And to also let you know, members of the committee, is that in addition to academics, we have two lawyers on the...
Uh-oh. So,
just to let you know, so they were very close with thinking about whether or not they're with the University of Oregon or with other associations, so that's really important.
Thank you.
I could make my quick comment then.
Yes, please.
So that was perfect. Thank you for sharing that. That did just exactly what... okay, so here's the deal. The deal is that I think those definitions are reasonable and they're academic, and I think they're balanced. That's what I think. Okay, I'm one of, you know, millions of people that have to, you know, take that information and be comfortable with the information that we're given. Mm-hmm. And so the situation is that I think that the comment that the governor's office made was important. We need to understand and have trust in what an independent science review is. And then we need to understand that it's only one of a number of different inputs that we're going to get on any kind of a management or a legislative issue. And so sometimes we get comments made to us as legislators about, but that was a science review. You're not listening to what that science review said, that independent science review. And so I think it's important somewhere in the dialogue tomorrow that you talk about both the power of an independent science review and the limitations of an independent science review. Because it is only as good as the definitions, or it only reflects and bounces off the definitions, and it only goes as far as what the review or methodology actually took on. Because a different methodology could take on a different type of independent science review on the very same subject. So that's just for whatever it's worth. But you asked if we had a comment.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
I have one question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frederick, followed by Representative Esquivel.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that, Mr. Chair. There are a number. We could spend several hours on this, wine or not. So,
wine make it better.
Well, that's true. I'm not sure we would remember much of it if we did, though. There is a couple of things that come to mind for me. One is, I'm really pleased to see this kind of a review taking place. I think we need to, and I'll just plug it, I think we need to have a review of the scientific research going on in the state of Oregon, natural and otherwise. Mm-hmm. So we don't have that right now. I think we've done that in the past. One of the things that I'm reminded of is the science committee that was done in the 80s. If you haven't seen that, you should take a look at it. It was primarily dealing with silicon-based work, but it had a pretty good impact on the rest of the state. So I'd like to see that. I worry about this concept of pure science, because that always seems to say as though there is a final distinct answer that is forever more. And the fact of science is that it is a pursuit of knowledge. And so there are continued research things that we're getting more information about, and how we handle that information, I think, is the key. It's also important, I think, for us to get past the idea of some of the policy approaches is to look at the extreme ends of the spectrum. I joked when I was a science reporter that I did not include the Flat Earth Society when I talked about a shuttle launch. Because it didn't seem to be appropriate. It didn't seem to be accurate, and there just was no reason to put that in. I think we need to understand that as well, and the changes that have taken place. At one time, there was no problem with DDT. And I remember, you know, spraying insecticide without covering myself or anything else. And then, then we finally began to understand that there were other issues that were associated with that. I think it's appropriate for us to continue to understand the pursuit of knowledge, and that, that that is what we should be working with. Yes, there's going to be bias because there, we are people. Even if we, even when we program a machine or a system, some system, we insert bias into that as well by what we look at and what we don't look at. So I think it's important for us to continue to look at this and use what we can at this point and search for the times when we have holes in our arguments that are appropriate or inappropriate. I appreciate this particular effort, and I want to see what you get out of it. It should be fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, we've been kind of chit-chatting here. Was the research on the spotted owl independent? Because it was obviously flawed. We put thousands of people out of work, and for no reason at all.
Again, it's so tempting to get into a very lengthy discussion, and I'm going to try, this is hard, to keep it short. There are probably 3,000 different articles published on spotted owls by a number of different people. None of the individual articles, I would say, is you could maybe call independent, but if you, again, collectively look at all of them, you're reaching some diversity of opinion, and I'll leave it at that.
I want to thank you for your stated intention here, and I think it was you, Lisa. I'm not sure. I can't remember. But the comment was that our intention is to, in essence, present the spectrum of scientific opinion on matters. That I think is exceedingly helpful to us as policymakers, and I agree completely with Representative Barreto that it is imperative that we have the scientific review in order for us to be able to ground our decisions relative to public policy. We cannot be, any of us, even close to expert on maybe even a fraction of the issues that come before us. We have to be able to rely on science to inform the opinions that we are making constantly in this legislature. And to the extent that we have that broad spectrum presented to us, that we understand the diversity of scientific opinion on any given issue, helps is helpful in formulating our own opinions, in understanding what makes sense in the real world or not. And frankly, I find it exceedingly helpful to challenge assumptions, to challenge maybe our own opinions. And if we arrive at an opinion, to know that it has been challenged, and it's solid enough, that decision is sound enough to withstand the diversity of opinion, to withstand challenges by others. So I commend you for that approach, and thank you very much. I know that there are two others here in the panel who really haven't had an opportunity to make their presentation yet, and I would like to make sure that you have that opportunity. So please decide between yourselves what more you have to say.
I think that concludes our presentation.
All right. Well, committee members, any last-minute questions or comments here? Representative Whitsitt, please.
Yes, I'd just like to add that I hope that you will use reproducible empirical data over modeling also when you make the final, your final discussion on, identifying what the process is, because I think it's really important that we use actual data versus selected data for modeling. So that would just be last thing I think is important.
Representative Whitsitt, thank you for that final comment. Going back to one of Rep. Krieger's earlier comments, we did both serve simultaneously on the Board of Forestry, and ground truthing would have been exceedingly helpful in determining harvest levels of our state's forests. Modeling failed us miserably in that.
50% off.
50% off. And again, folks, I want to underscore that it was not a lack of wanting the best available science. In this instance, it happened to be largely a matter of resources. We didn't have the money. We didn't have at that time necessarily the ability to go out and ground truth it for a host of reasons. Again, it could take hours of discussion. But it points up the importance of that empirical knowledge. And Rep. Whitsitt, thank you so much for that point.
I just have one last
thing. Yes, please.
And can you make sure that you include statistical significance in your definitions
yes.
that you're working on? Thank
yes.
you.
Yes, thank you.
I want to thank the three of you so very, very much. And as one person who, as a non-scientist, was interviewed for this, I can tell you that I was thoroughly engaged for about 40 minutes. And as chance would have it, I was interviewed by phone, and the phone call came in while I was driving up the coast, and I pulled into Boiler Bay Overlook to do my 40-minute interview, and it was absolutely captivating, both the scenery and the discussion. And I think the pollster had to finally shut me up. It was that it was that engaging. So, thank you so very, very much for this opportunity. Truly appreciate it.
Thank you all for your time.
With that, I am going to close the informational meeting on the Task Force on Independent Scientific Review, and I'm going to open an informational meeting on the Rogue Spring Chinook Conservation Plan, and like to call up, please, Ed Bowles and Russ Stoff. And while they're on their way up, I noticed that we had four folks who came in together. I presume you are a group. And maybe you could tell us who you are and why you're here.
We're from Lebanon High School, down a little south of here. And we're just here, we're on a field trip today with our AP government class. Just watch some committees in action.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, welcome to Lebanon High School, and welcome to your capital, and I hope you find your visit today here both informative and enjoyable. So, good to see you here.
And they chose the premier committee.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Check's in the mail. with that, gentlemen, welcome, and please decide among yourselves the order of your testimonies.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, my name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we're pleased to be invited to come share with you kind of an update on our Rogue Spring Chinook Conservation Plan, which has been in place now for almost 10 years. And I brought along a certified smart guy for the department. This is Russ Stoff. He's our Rogue Watershed District Manager. And Russ, along with many stakeholders and his staff, were the architects of this plan. And it's up for a review, a 10-year review next year. And so we're excited to reconvene the stakeholders and actually take a look objectively at what's working and what isn't, and see if there's some modifications and changes that need to occur, and that process will take place next year. But we're glad to give you an update now. As you've probably heard, fishing hasn't been the best down there this spring, and these spring Chinook are iconic, and we're in the midst of a relatively sour ocean right now, which is affecting a lot of our fisheries. But there are some good pieces to the story as well. And so Russ is going to give you a quick overview of that before you have your public panel. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Witt, representatives, committee members. For the record, my name is Russ Stoff, as Ed pointed out. I'm currently the Rogue Watershed Manager for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife in Central Point on the Rogue. I've been at that for about 13 years. Prior to that, I was in Gold Beach as the district fisheries biologist for 10 years. And I'll provide you 15 slides. I'll move through them pretty quickly on an update of the plan, what briefing on the plan and how we structured the plan, and then update the information on where we're at, some of the issues we're evaluating prior to the 10-year review that's coming up next year. And before I forget, I'd like to point out that we have two members of our Public Advisory Committee in the room today, Steve Byerlin and Peter Tronquet. And this was a very involved process with the Public Advisory Committee. And kudos to them and the other members, because as you'll see, it was a long, drawn-out process with a lot of commitment, a lot of meetings. So I just wanted to orient us on the Rogue River Basin and Spring Chinook first. The plan is relative to Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's native fish conservation policy. And so the species management unit there on the bottom, that's just jargon for, within the policy for the population that we're talking about. The population of Spring Chinook in the Rogue River has historically always been upstream of Gold Ray Dam. Gold Ray Dam is marked prominently there. It no longer exists. It was removed in 2010, along with another main stem, Rogue River Dam, a couple of years prior to that, Savage Rapids, which had been beneficial to Spring Chinook. Spring Chinook habitat was, and is there a pointer? It was blocked. The upper 25% of the historic Spring Chinook habitat was blocked by Lost Creek Dam. It was very productive habitat, and it accounted for about a third of the natural wild Spring Chinook production. And most of that habitat is inundated under the reservoir. Well, not entirely all of it, but the vast majority of it. So the program for mitigation is in the hatchery that Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife operates, are managed by, or owned rather, and funded by the Army Corps of Engineers, operated by ODF&W. And that's Coal Rivers Hatchery at Lost Creek Dam there. The issue that became apparent to us in the late 90s was the decline of wild spring Chinook in the Rogue River. And the decline of wild spring Chinook is largely due to reservoir operations at Lost Creek Dam and Lost Creek Reservoir. It's beneficial to fish in some ways, but it has impacts on spring Chinook. The dam and the projects in the Rogue are noteworthy in that they're the only congressionally authorized dam projects in the United States with fisheries management as a primary authorized use. Second to flood control, fisheries management was the primary authorized use for the reservoir, along with municipal and irrigation water diversions. In addition to that, it's got an allocation of water for fish of 125,000 acre feet at Lost Creek Reservoir, and Applegate, which is an associated project in the Applegate Basin, it's got an allocation of water of 45,000 acre feet that are to be used strictly to benefit fisheries in the Rogue. So because of operations at the reservoir, largely has to do with water temperature on the incubating spring Chinook eggs that are downstream of the dam. So the spring Chinook historically have been main stem spawners in the Rogue, upstream of Gold Ray Dam, and about 5% of the population in the lower 1 mile or so of Big Butte Creek. But the rest of them in the main stem, what's left is the river below the dam. And while we can control water temperature out of the reservoir because of the ports that were built in the tower behind the dam, we can only control the water temperature up until about Thanksgiving, when the prevailing winds from the winter will mix it, and then it ends up being about 3 degrees warmer than it was historically, and that causes the eggs that are in the gravel downstream to incubate out of the gravel sooner than they would have naturally. So they're coming out of the gravel at the end of February, early in March, instead of April when they would have historically. That's a principal cause of mortality on wild spring Chinook and the Rogue. There's some other issues with how the Corps would operate the dam relative to flood control, and when they're doing flood control, of course, course, that trumps fish management. But coming off of that, there were issues with ramping rates when they decreased flows and things like that that were impactive. And so a primary purpose of our plan was to identify what we could work with the Corps to have some leverage with the Army Corps of Engineers to improve those operational issues that we could change. So again, the primary limiting factors were the limited spawning habitat of the Upper Rogue, that 30 miles of main stem river, the reservoir operation, in that harvest rates in the in-river fishery were pretty high on the early run historic spring Chinook that come in April and May, simply because they're in the river so long, subject to a lot of harvest pressure. At the same time, the reservoirs favored later run Chinook, so that's something we've been struggling with. There's still a lot of Chinook produced in the Upper Rogue River, but over time they've sort of morphed into more similar to fall Chinook. We began the Spring Chinook Conservation Plan in 2004. We did that under the then relatively new Native Fish Conservation Policy. We developed the Advisory Committee, and the Advisory Committee was made up of 8 public members of the committee, 6 of whom were licensed guides on the Rogue River, 2 representing other fisheries interests. And we had also 6 members on the Advisory Committee of federal agencies like the Corps of Engineers, NOAA Fisheries, federal land managers, and 2 members of Oregon State Police. It took us almost 4 years to do the plan. It was adopted in September of 2007, and it is, like as Ed pointed out, due to a 10-year review next year. The public involvement, as I pointed out, for these guys on the advisory committee was pretty intensive. We held 24 meetings at locations either in Central Point, Grants Pass, or Gold Beach over almost 4 years of putting them together. We have a wealth of information available to us on the Rogue River because the Army Corps of Engineers funded evaluations of the potential impacts of the dams prior and after construction of the dams, and that was conducted by ODF&W. So we have a lot of information to work through. The goal of the public involvement was to take all the time necessary to answer all the questions, get everybody's comfortable with the information, and to work through that. After we developed the draft plan, we opened that up, of course, for public comment, and we held 2 public hearings on the draft plan, both in Gold Beach and in the Medford area. In the process of working through all the information with the advisory committee, we actually developed 9 alternatives for discussion. Only 2 of these alternatives were realistic alternatives that had support from our advisory committee, but we wanted to flesh out all available options in the process of putting the plan together. So we ended up with 2 alternatives, alternative 8 and 9, that were supported either by the advisory committee and or the public. We were split in the support for the alternatives. Of the 8 public members of the advisory committee, 5 of them supported alternative 8, 3 of them supported alternative 9. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife recommended alternative 9 to our commission. And alternative 9, when it went through scientific review and through the technical review of the members of the team, it also had support from those members. So there's unanimous support outside of the 5 members of the public that supported alternative 8. The primary differences between the 2 alternatives have to do with expanding spring Chinook habitat in the Upper Rogue River. In alternative 8, would rely on expanding spring Chinook production into areas where they historically weren't present. And to do that, it was the opinion of ODF&W's technical staff that it would require water. We'd need additional water storage and additional water to augment flows in those streams so we could produce spring Chinook at the right times out of them. We didn't think that was available. We saw no viable alternative to go forward with that. The other differences were in terms of fish transportation, so we'd have to trap and haul fish into some of these areas that they currently couldn't access because there's barriers on some of them. And then the hatchery production was a little bit different. That's not a big point, but alternative 9 called for us to shift some of the production that the Corps of Engineers pays for out of coho production because those fish aren't caught in any of the fisheries at a very high rate, and we shifted some of that production into additional spring Chinook hatchery. So we've increased the spring Chinook smolt release from 1.62 million in the Rogue to 1.85 million as we adopted the plan. And under Alternative 9, we made some changes in the upper river management that allowed us to target those more abundant later run Chinook that we're seeing produced post Lost Creek Dam. And so that opened up about 15 miles of the upper river in July and August to a fishery that had previously been closed. And that's targeted on that late run component, not the early one. And those were the primary differences between the alternatives. As I pointed out earlier, one of the primary purposes for the plan was to be able to negotiate changes to reservoir operation with the Army Corps of Engineers. And so as an update on that, one of the things that they hadn't done prior to plan development was adopt our recommendations on how the fisheries enhancement water should best be used into their operating manual for their dam operators that largely work out of the Portland office. Since we've adopted the plan, they have adopted those measures in the plan into their operational manual. We also called for a temperature model that would help us to deal with that temperature issue that I talked about, so how we could minimize the impacts, rather, of the increased temperature in the winter months on those spring Chinook and the gravel. They've completed the temperature model that allows us to tweak that to the best of our ability to protect that early run component. And they've become much more proactive in managing flow. So we actually get to use more than the 125,000 acre feet that's allocated for fish, because much of the water behind Lost Creek Reservoir is currently unappropriated. There's water for municipal and irrigation that nobody takes as of this time. The Corps has to get down to minimum pool by the fall, so they allow us to use that for fish. They've become more flexible with that. And without that flexibility, last year in the drought conditions, for instance, we would likely have lost 15 or 20,000 Chinook in the Rogue Canyon. Because they become more flexible, we got them to go into the carryover storage, kind of gamble on this year, and protect those fish. In addition, we've done habitat improvements that we addressed in the plan. So we've done gravel augmentation in that big Butte Creek upstream of the mile that they're historically present in. We're trying to increase their production in a reach upstream of there that they can swim into. And that's an ongoing project. We put gravel in there 2 years ago, couldn't get the funding last year, or attempting to get the grants to do it again this year. The removal of Savage Rapids and Gold Ray Dams in the Rogue River has benefited Spring Chinook dramatically. And we modified the Gold Tier Irrigation Dam downstream of Medford to benefit downstream immigration of them, and that was a cooperative project done to screen their diversion. We're also evaluating hatchery spring Chinook smolt releases. And so we release that 1.85 million smolts. Typically, we've released those in three groups in August, September, and October, pretty much evenly split between them. We've tweaked it around a little bit. But because, and we fully understand the concerns with the lack of success in the fishery in Gold Beach this year, and in previous years, excuse me, it's not been good for a couple of years. So staff, we've identified an effort to try and determine how we can get the best bang for the buck out of our smolt releases. And as you can see, so we've got August in blue, September in the gold, and October in the gray. It's not really clear. Lately, October's been a little bit more beneficial, but we'll continue to tweak the evaluation of the timing. In addition to that, we've added a release group of yearling smolts. These fish go out before they're 1 year of age as smolts. Historically, some of the spring Chinook smolts went out as one-year-olds, and so we've added that back in post-plan adoption, and hopefully those will help contribute to the fishery. And we've compared survival of our hatchery smolts to other basins, particularly Trinity, which has a similar ocean migration pattern. So the Trinity and the Klamath have similar life history characteristics to Rogue Spring Chinook. And as you can see, they pretty well track, although we do outperform. We threw Rock Creek hatchery on the Umpqua in there just as another evaluation. But I think the primary point would be between Trinity hatchery and Coal Rivers hatchery. And they do track pretty closely, although we do outperform consistently at Coal Rivers hatchery.
Representative Woodstock.
I have a question, two back. Where I'm sitting, I can't see. What happened between 86 and 89?
So between 1986 and 19,
I don't know if that's exactly right, because I'm sitting sideways here. So
are you seeing a gap in one of them, or the high survival rate?
The downturn.
Oh, the downturn there. The downturn there, that was a significant El Nino event with some really poor ocean survival on Chinook across the board for us.
And the next time from 2002 to 2005?
Similar. Very similar.
El Nino. This
is really reflective. If you track ocean conditions in El Nino, it really I should have overlaid that actually for you, Senator Whitson, or Representative Whitson, I apologize. But these really do represent those ocean conditions quite well.
Right. So are you taking that into consideration when you're putting all these proposals up and everything? It seems like it's more of a natural phenomenon that we're seeing in these downturns related to the ocean than things that you're doing terrestrially upriver or whatever. I mean, it's just...
I think it's a key point, Representative Whitsitt, and something that we struggle with because there's only so much of this that we can control. In an earlier slide, I identified manageable factors, manageable limiting factors, and ocean conditions largely being reflective of large-scale weather, or, you know, a difficult thing to manage.
If I may follow up. So we're in one of those now, right?
Correct. Again. Correct.
So would that be...
That's why they're relatively down in 10 and 11, and we don't have the returns off of those smolts yet to evaluate. So we evaluate that based on the returning adults from that smolt release.
So we might expect that in the next couple of years we're going to see another one of these.
I think it's fair to say that we're worried about next year as well as this year.
Thank you.
And I'm pretty much at the end here. I just wanted to point out wild spring Chinook production in the basin since plant adoption has been on the increase. And so the major metric of the plan is 15,000 fish. A 10-year average of 15,000 wild Chinook is a desired status element, and we have to attain that before we're allowed to open it back up to wild fish harvest in the Rogue. And so the goal, of course, is to attain that. It's not proven attainable in the 10 years since we've adopted the plan, unfortunately. We were hopeful we would be able to. But you can see that with the exception of 2014, which we're not entirely sure, there was a peak flow event that winter that could have impacted fish in 2010 on the immigrating juveniles from that breed that may have impacted them. We really don't know, to be honest. But we have made great progress with the plan. And these issues of weather... You know what, the appropriateness of those metrics and other uses, the other methods we can get to increase spring Chinook production on the Rogue, we intend to evaluate in the 10-year plan, in the 10-year review. So in summary, reservoir operations have been modified for greater fisheries benefit. There have been significant improvements to habitat and fish passage, and numbers have been increasing despite not attaining the 10-year status. And there are elements that we intend to update in the 10-year plan. Principally, we've been able to develop enough age information on the way we count spring Chinook now that Gold Ray Dam is out. The beginning next year, we'll also be able to do a preseason abundance forecast. And when we do the preseason abundance forecast for the upcoming run, we'll be able to roll that number into the average for the desired status element, because what's really holding us down on the desired status element are those low years of 2005 and 6 and 7 now. And you know, as we go forward, those low years start to drop off. If we can increase survivability of wild fish, that forecast will allow us to bring it up even further. And that concludes my presentation.
Vice Chair Krieger.
We've had presentations here on smolt migration periods on just about everything. And of course the Nehalem study on predation talked about the horizontal curve. Here comes April, it comes up April, May, June 15th, it drops off. How does the Rogue compare to that as far as the migration of the wild spring Chinook?
The wild spring Chinook can be pretty variable, but generally they're going out earlier. So they're going out earlier than this. They're dropping down. We're not able to evaluate it currently because we've not been able to invest the time necessary, and it's difficult to sort out which are spring Chinook and which are fall Chinook, which are all mixed in the estuary. But the completion reports and the research that we did through the 90s showed an earlier immigration than the smolt release, but later than that April fall Chinook stuff you saw up on the Nestuck, or Nehalem rather. So primarily July and August.
That's the wild fish migrating out?
Correct.
Then, you know, the controversy has been, hey, when do you release the hatchery fish? And because that water is lower, warmer, all the predators are available. And then, of course, the estuary with the water we have down there. I'm not certain they hold as long, or the smallest smolts that hit the ocean on the Oregon coast. Why would you not release them? If they come in and they spawn at the same time as a wild fish, basically, why wouldn't you release them to migrate out during the same period of time?
I didn't put that on the slide, and I apologize for that, Representative Krieger. We had experimental releases in the 80s and 90s of earlier releases, and they all performed poorly, very, very poorly compared to the later releases. So going into the 80s and 90s, we tweaked that to favor the higher survival rates, which were August, September, October.
Please.
I think it was, you said in 14 we had nearly hit the 15,000 wild fish. And if you went back to, I'm thinking 85, somewhere in there, we had around 85,000 total adults that were both wild and hatchery. And so, why aren't we getting a higher survival rate of those smolts that are hatchery fish? I'm being told a question, though, that we're not getting a survival rate that you might experience somewhere else where you're showing that the survival rate is high. And if the survival rate is high and you're putting out 1.85 million fish, yet most of the fish that are caught in the early part of the year by far are wild fish, where are those hatchery fish that you think are surviving because they're not showing up in the catch in the river?
My concern, and we want to continue to evaluate that, Representative Krieger, and find out how we can best tweak that. So we by no means are saying that we've got this understood and we need to stand on a method we're employing now. However, the low survival rates that we're currently seeing and reflected in 2010-11 there, and really, you know, all the way back to 06 and before, my concern is that what we're seeing is largely an effect of poor ocean conditions. And I realize that you know, that people get tired of hearing that, and boy, you know, I think we get tired of saying it as well. But I do think that we have disparities in survival rates in the ocean. We know from Elk River Hatchery that our hatchery returns and our wild Chinook returns don't co-vary within a year. So hatchery fish can vary quite a bit compared to the wild fish for whatever reason. And on poor ocean conditions, we see an increasingly disparity on survival rate of the hatchery fish. And my worry is that it's largely that condition driving it. And I hope we're wrong, because that's a difficult one for us to address. But we are moving forward with evaluating different release strategies within the basin, different timings with the yearling release in March, evaluating the survival data by release group. And so those are things that we want to bring forward to the table in 2000 and next year at the 10-year review. And look at, you know, what's our committee think? You know, what do our advisors think? Can we make progress on that?
What's your estimate of the wild fish harvest rate in the upper river?
That slide on
it, I think. So the wild fish harvest rate currently, I mean, it's closed wild fish harvest for the early run spring Chinook. But I've got some addendum slides.
Well, the early run, Russ, but the fact that they get there, let's say in late March, April, and they're there, clear all the way through. So then you get a dilution of those wild fish, early run fish, with fish that stack up behind. But that doesn't mean you're not going to be catching some of those wild fish before up to the time that either the season closes or they spawn.
And that's a concern what we discussed and identified in the planning process. We would very much like to be able to put out, we did a little bit of this in 2007, but we'd really like to be able to put out enough radio tags in early run fish, capturing them in the lower river, radio tagging them so that we can track their survivability in the upper basin. It's a very good point in that these fish hold in the upper river upstream of Dodge Bridge largely now, so near Shady Cove, and they're subject to catch and release in the directed fishery for the hatchery product for 2 months. And the concern, if I'm understanding Representative Krieger, is hook and release mortality over time on those fish. That's very much a concern that I share, and that the department and I think the advisor shared. We'd like to get at that answer. You know, we've been sort of scrambling to do the adult carcass survey so we can do the run reconstruction and get the wild fish numbers. We've not really been funded to do much effort there. It's pretty much been an extracurricular effort for the office. You know, that sort of work is a little expensive, but we would look for the opportunity.
Russ, you are
rep down there for, what, 10 years, 12 years, something like that.
Correct.
And I worked together, knew each other, clear back to the time I had that other job, that prior life. I went by the Lower River the other day, and Jots, Alexa's Landing, and the other one on the other side of the river, there was not one boat tied up to any of those docks. Larry's at Fromm's, you know, Alexa's Landing, had two trailers there that had been there all winter, not one of them there to fish spring Chinook, where we historically had 25 to 40 boats from from the ferry hole down. I don't know if you ever hit 15 or 20 all year. It's devastated the community as far as economics. It's been impossible for a lot of the guides to really take a party out there. And they're catching wild fish to some degree. They have to turn them loose, but they're not having the same success with hatchery fish. So if you're releasing ever how many hatchery fish there are, you would think that they would be represented in that total number of the total run, which hasn't been much for wild fish, that you'd have so many more hatchery fish by the percentage that of your releases of success that you'd be the other way around. You'd be catching more. So at some point, the department can evaluate from now to the time that I'm 85 instead of 75, but if it doesn't get any more fish, I fished in the Rogue once since 2001. That used to be my big fishery. I just loved it. But there's a lot of people dropping out because there is no opportunity anymore. And so if you want to increase license sales, here's another place where you can actually look at the opportunity. Colleen, you and my wife, I haven't bought her a salmon tag in 15 years. She used to buy one every year and a license. You have dozens and dozens of people in Gold Beach alone that are in that position. I think throughout the entire state, I think it runs into the thousands and thousands. The lack of opportunity, why we're trying to get science. Well, at some point, we've got to have a way of evaluating a little bit better. And of course, you said, I think, two or three times, well, we don't have adequate money for this, or we don't have adequate money for that. You have 450-some biologists, and I think that maybe the department has got to start prioritizing what you do rather than take on new things. And that's actually part of the conversation with the 2402 committee about alternative funding for your organization. I don't want to take up any more time. We've got a lot of people to go.
Representative Barreto, followed by Representative Esquivel.
Actually, Representative Krieger covered everything I was going to say, except that I was down at Grants Pass when Representative Wilson put on that thing, and I appreciate you educating me in Biology 101 salmon recovery. So I still have a lot of questions, and I asked Lindsey Ball yesterday about it, you know, some of the things I learned down there, and Lindsey was saying that over in Russia, I think there's 8 billion fish out of hatcheries the salmon that they're letting go every year. Is that about right?
Chair Whip, Representative Barreto, I'm not sure of that number, but I'll get you.
Well, and he said that Russia was sending out another 8 billion because they're having the same issues over there too. So I mean, I could have my numbers wrong, but when we were talking about, we were down there in Grants Pass talking about the hatchery boxes, you know, that maybe would coincide with some of those earlier runs, and you know, trying to bring those back. And what I took out of the meeting down there is you're trying to get a more pure strain of wild fish than you are hatchery or hatch boxes or anything to increase the runs artificially. So to me, and I think along with Representative Krieger, you know, to get the runs up, if the fish that we let go, if some of them come back and we send out 1.8 million fish and we can send out 5 million fish, you know, the better the chance of getting just a few more back in would be good, but I don't know exactly what the cost is of raising those hatchery fish. But I mean, I think everyone's looking at increasing the runs down there, and sometimes I think when we go back to the, you know, in my own opinion, you know, trying to get back to the very natural selection process, then we basically slow down economically, you know, what's going on down there. One of the other questions I had, you in your
you had the historical in your plan number 9. You had an introduction to non-historical habitat, and you had no on that. And I was wondering what that non-historical habitat was.
Those are Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, those are tributaries in the Upper Rogue, like Big Butte upstream of where they're currently distributed, Spring Sugar currently distributed, and Little Butte Creek, as well as some other tributaries in the Rogue, where Spring Chinook did not historically reproduce. And the idea was that if we could get them into some of those reaches of streams that have suitable spawning habitat, and we could ensure that there was enough water available for them, we could have additional natural production to help us meet that desired status goal. So that was not an alternative, not an option listed under Alternative 9, but was rather under Alternative 8.
Right.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Butte Creek reminds me of how would you control that temperature? Because it gets pretty warm in the summer. I mean, very warm. But anyway, that's probably a different challenge. When did you, and you may have covered this and I missed it, but when did you start not releasing the fish from the hatchery the same time that the naturals are going down? When did you change that? Because you look at that last, I'd like you to go back to that graph you had that showed the return of the fish.
I think.
Not that one. That one. You know, there's something incredibly wrong with that picture. And I'll tell you what it is. Look at, we had, in 1996, we had a bad year. But 95, 97, 98, 99, 2000, 2001, we kind of have this, okay, I get that. But then you go back, and you only have one real spike year. And it hasn't been because of El Nino for 15 years. Something's wrong. So when did you start doing a different time frame on the release of the hatchery fish versus the natural fish?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, those evaluations took place prior to 1995, so the return rates reflected here are all combinations of the August, September, October releases, which when our evaluations in the 80s showed a much higher survival than the earlier release. And it may have been that we were, you know, I think it's unclear as to what the impacts were on earlier release strategies, but we may have been putting those on top of wild spring Chinook smolts that were causing competition issues.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is what we're doing now isn't working. That's pretty obvious. But what I'm asking here is that when did you start manipulating the release of the hatchery fish in conjunction with that, with the natural fish? Because I've been told it's been, you're starting to release those in August, September, October, well, August and September. And, of course, that's the time that the Rogue River's the lowest, and that's the time when it's the hottest. So your survival rate would go down. I guess I'm missing something here.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, the August release has largely been successful because we augment flows out of the reservoir in August to benefit Chinook, adult Chinook that are in the canyon at that time. And so the August release has been largely associated with increased flows out of the reservoir and has likely accounted for the high survival, because that release group did have some of the highest survival rates. And that's the release group in August. And so, you know, in the early 90s, it was showing pretty good performance. But the idea between having the three release groups was to find out if we could find an advantage, some way to maximize our bang for the buck in those release groups. And that, lately October's shown a little more promise, I would say, out of that. But it's not been clear. I agree with you. We would very much like to see higher survival rates on those.
Well, just back up another one. Let's go back to that thing and look at that picture.
Absolutely.
So what we're doing is not working. Because you can't tell me that we had El Nino from 95, a difference we had from 2002 to 2011, we've had El Nino, because that's not true.
Okay, I got to ask a question.
No, something's wrong.
Vice Chair McLean.
So now I'm confused. So did I not hear you say that you started the releases that he's talking about in 1995? Or not?
80s.
Right. Chair Witt, Representative McLean. No, the slide time frame is only the since 1995. It was just a selection of a range of survivals up to date.
The releases are all the same, or they are different, as he indicated they would?
The releases have included those August, September, October release groups since the 80s.
Okay.
And so we've been doing that strategy. There were some experimental evaluations prior to that in the 80s that showed dismal survival out of an earlier release.
Okay.
So, Russ, we don't have the recovery on the hatchery fish that we'd like. We don't have the science that we would like necessarily. We're not sure of the interplay between natural and man-made factors. Where does Russ think we go from here?
Chair Witt, so I think that we have a pretty good understanding of the impacts of the reservoir, and it's got limitations. So the reservoir now inherently favors fall Chinook and later run Chinook. The goal of the plan, because of the importance to all of the public and the anglers on the Rogue River, the goal of the plan was to preserve and protect that early run spring Chinook life history if possible. And so that focus on reservoir operations, in my opinion, has been largely successful. Mm-hmm. So we've gotten the Corps to make the changes that we asked of them. We've seen the benefits of that in those Chinook numbers. I think now we need to better understand how to maximize the bang for the buck out of our hatchery program to better meet the mitigation goal. And to be perfectly honest, Chair Witt, we've tried to understand that and move forward with that. We clearly are having some problems, but we want to increase the benefit of that to the anglers on the Rogue, if at all possible. So that's the intent of the 10-year review, is to try and understand that better.
Thank you. Anything further? Representative Whitson.
I had the opportunity, I believe someone told me that this is what I was seeing. I was whale watching, and I saw what was described to me as one of those factory ships. And I was wondering, what sort of influence are they having? It was off Cape Foulweather, like way out there. And I was shocked at the size of one of those things. I'd heard about them, but I couldn't believe the size of this thing. And it sat there for probably 4 hours, just slowly moved. And it was described to me by the personnel at Cape Foulweather that it was a factory ship out there. I assume an international, so does our government keep track of these? They describe them as sweeping everything in their path, essentially. And I was just wondering, are they partly responsible for what's happening to some of our fisheries off the coast?
Chair Witt and Representative Whitsitt, I'll take a stab at that. The our Pacific Fish Management Council manages or federally managed fisheries, which you're referring to, out to the exclusive economic zone of 200 miles, and the sort of large international fleet, the high seas drift net, the big factory ships, it really is not a factor in our fisheries. We do have some very large vessel operations for some of our economically important fisheries off the coast, and I would venture a guess that you may have been seeing one of those occurring for, even our shrimp fisheries are pretty large trawl vessels, as well as some of our other ground fish stocks. And so those are very economically important to Oregon, and most of those landings, even some of the factory ship stuff, do land in some of our coasts. coastal communities. Those are managed relative to bycatch of these sensitive species, and those are closely maintained, and those go into their regulations of those. And so I would venture a guess, without knowing exactly what you saw, I can't speculate, but I would imagine that those are likely federally managed fisheries and vessels that are economically important to Oregon, and those are managed under that framework with bycatch of our listed salmon species, as well as marine sensitive species, very tightly controlled.
Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much. I'd like to call up now, please, Steve Byerlin, Rick Howard, and Denny Houston.
Just got a quick little comment before they start. Thank you.
Please, Representative Krieger, your comment?
I think I have to state a conflict of interest. I've known these are constituents of mine. I've known them when I had that blue uniform on, so I can't make any other further comments about their character.
But it was always a pleasurable experience that you had.
I think we should give them, Mr. Chair, the opportunity to make comments about Representative Krieger.
He's, you know, I was just thinking about those rogue dam operators, you know. Gentlemen, welcome to our committee. Please determine among yourselves the order of your testimonies, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Representative Witt. I'm Rick Howard. I've been a fishing guide since 1995. I fished the Rogue since I was 12 years old in 1962, so I've got a lot of history on the South Coast. What I want to address will fit right into a lot of your questions that you've had and the testimony that Rustoff has given. The numbers that we see on the Rogue River this year are rather dismal. And if you equate the 22 days that I've spent on the river, I've landed 28 salmon, and I've got to retain 8 of them. And of those, we've had 4 guided trips. And of those 4 guided trips, they got to retain 1 fish. I'm just a little nervous. I'm going to calm down here. So if you equate the numbers for the hatchery release of 1.5 million plus, mm-hmm. and you do the 3-to-1, that's 4.5 million wild juveniles on a ratio that are in that lower basin that got to the ocean. And I would contend that there was not 4.5 million wild juveniles, not even close. So I don't know, did you get my letter here? I want to read this letter, and it'll address some of the issues that we've kind of talked about. And the purpose of this letter is to restore the wild spring salmon to a population of a harvestable level. And you know, we're releasing the wild fish, and you know, so far that's how we're going to have to do it. But it's not the best thing to do. Okay, so follow me with this. Spring salmon spawn in late September through October, and the juveniles come out of the gravel in late December through January into February. They immediately begin their migration to the lower river. By mid-July, the mainstream of the river is warming and usually has reached a 70-degree level. The majority of the juveniles are in the lower 3 miles of the basin by August. The tidewater mix is nutrient-rich and is cooled with ocean tidal influence, and over the past 15 years, the water volume has been depleted by 80% in that lower basin. Gravel from the Elephant Rock area has eroded and filled the bay. Where there was once a 20-foot depth is either now dry at low tide or is a 2 to 6 foot deep or shallow flat. This has created a killing field for the salmon juveniles. Rafts of 200 cormorants and large population of harbor seals are decimating the juveniles. It is critical that the lower basin from the Coast Guard station to Woodruff River will be excavated to that 20-foot depth. This will create a safer rearing basin for the juveniles, as well as giving the returning summer and fall Chinook a larger area to acclimate. There are no juveniles in the lower basin from mid-November through mid-March, and it's a perfect time to set up a gravel removal. If this gravel is not removed, the population of wild spring salmon will continue to decrease. That is their nursery habitat. Spring salmon hatchery juveniles reared at the Coal Rivers hatchery are released in three groups, as stated, August, September, and October. These fish are physically healthy when they are released and are fed at regular intervals with food dispersed on the surface with automatic feeders. Day after day, they depend on the feeders for their next meal. It's conditioning. Then they are released into the river 154 miles upstream from the wild juveniles. For the next several days, the hatchery juveniles are anticipating food pellets raining down from the surface for their food. When they leave the hatchery, the water temperature in August is near 58 degrees, and after 6 days and 60 miles downriver, the temperature is 70 degrees. Being weakened by poor food intake and stress by rising water temperature, the fish are easy prey for pike minnows, mergansers, and cormorants. And after 3 weeks, the majority of the hatchery juveniles that survived the stress and the mid-river predation are now in the tidal region competing for food with the wild juveniles that have adapted to foraging in the bay. The weak hatchery juveniles become easy prey for the cormorants and seals, and it's no wonder that hatchery fish are doing so poorly. If it's true that less than half the hatchery fish released at Coal Rivers Hatchery actually reach the ocean, that's totally unacceptable. It's not logical to expect hatchery juveniles to survive a migration at a time of year that Mother Nature does not have any fish migrating. There are reasons that Chinook juveniles don't migrate 154 miles downstream in August, September, and October. Is because they won't survive.
Thank you.
I would beseech ODFMW to consider trucking half the spring salmon juveniles to the lower river and release them at the ferry hole 3 miles up from the bay after the wild juveniles have exited into the ocean. By allowing August and September hatchery juveniles to compete for the same food source only results in diminishing the wild survival as well as the hatchery fish. It has been argued that hatchery juveniles are weaker and less able to survive. When they are put in impossible conditions as forced upon them by the ODFMW, resulting in poor food sources, water temperature stress, and heavy predation, it's no wonder. Later releases of hatchery fish would allow for a better food availability, less stress from water temperature changes, and less predation, especially from pike minnows, as they are more active at temperatures above 60 degrees. It is argued that the ocean conditions dictate the survivability of salmon runs. Now, we don't have any control of the ocean conditions, but we do have control of how we handle river habitat. By increasing the lower tidal rearing basin capacity and releasing the hatchery fish so they don't compete with the wild fish for the in-river food supply, it would greatly increase the number of juveniles that would escape to the ocean. In conclusion, we have altered the habitat for spring salmon on both ends of the river. Lost Creek Dam took out 20% of the spawning habitat. The dam has stopped all gravel recruitment downstream below the dam. The remaining 80% of spring salmon habitat has been diminished by 50% since the dam has been in place. That leaves about 40% of the natural spawning habitat remaining. That's not acceptable. The lower basin has been filled in by erosion caused by poor gravel excavation in the Elephant Rock area. Losing 80% of the water volume in the tidal area has diminished the rearing capacity. The tidal area is the nursery of the river. If we are going to see an increase in wild spring salmon returns in these areas of the river, need to be addressed. We don't need a 10-year study. We have just witnessed it. We need these areas addressed now. Excavation of the river gravel from the tidal area can be accomplished this winter. I urge those that make decisions to act. Next summer and fall could have great juvenile survival if we would just improve the habitat. The timing for gravel replacement below Lost Creek could be easily determined. As soon as this year's spring salmon juveniles exit the upper river in February and March, gravel placement could commence. If we fail to act on these two areas of critical habitat, we will see a continued decrease in wild spring salmon on the Rogue River. We have altered the river in ways that have put wild spring salmon in danger, and we need to take the steps to reverse the damage to the river and help the adults spawn and the juveniles to flourish. Please act. Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next?
Thank you, Chair Witt. My name is Steve Byerlin. I'm a 30-year guide on the Rogue River, but I fished the basin much longer than that, 20 or 25 years prior to that. I've spent time on the entire basin from the inundated area of the Rogue under the dam. I fished that before the dam was put in for many years. It was a wonderful piece of water. And I'm not an anti-dam guy. The dam has done a lot of good. But there are situations that we must go above and beyond to help, you know, solve some of the problems the dam's put in. Dam's 326 feet high. Gravel is not going to jump over that. And I think you had some photos there of the gravel or the spawning area. Some of it is up there now. Where that photo was taken used to be 1 inch to an inch and a half gravel, and it was used for spawning. And that's just below the dam by about half a mile where that photo was taken. You know, there was tremendous spawning on the upper Rogue and prior to the dam. There was about 13,000 fish that spawned behind the dam. I'm trying not to skip around here. I give my written testimony, and I'm going to try not to, you know, read that to you, you know. But there were some great questions here that I can help on, I think. The gravel that's in that area now is almost non-existent. And what is there? There's quite a few fish that use it, but they use it over and over and over again. So the last one to spawn is the one that's successful. The ones before get dug up, you know, because there's not enough gravel. So it needs to be put in there. In 1994, when that newspaper article was done, in 1994, when I copied it, I got it cut off. The letter from Representative Krieger asking about gravel from Rustoff was also in 1994, you know, 22 years ago. And to this date, there's been no gravel added to the main stem Rogue River. No plans to add gravel to the main stem Rogue River. The Corps engineer biologists believe in their projects that streams become gravel poor after their projects are put in. And in the newspaper article, they were willing at that time to do 65% of the cost of putting that gravel in there. And we had volunteers to do a lot of the work. But the reason why I didn't go forward is because ODFW said there's no proof there's less gravel now than there was prior to the dam being put in. Which is silly, but there was no studies done on gravel. So they had no studies, so they had nowhere to go on it, they felt, you know. But common sense, you know, and photographs and historic documentation, you know, will show that there was. I've kind of split my testimony between two things. One is wild fish, which was the spring salmon conservation plan, was primarily focused on natural producing wild fish. But we also have a requirement for mitigation for the effects of Lost Creek Dam. The dam was closed in 1977, and when it was closed, there were 13,000 wild springers spawning behind the dam. Mitigation was to replace those 13,000 wild spawners. About the best we seem to do is 8,000 returning hatchery fish to the hatchery. So it leaves us 5,000 fish short of the mitigation goals. And I think ODFW admit that they have never met mitigation goals for Lost Creek Dam. And to be clear, ODFW manages the hatchery and whatnot. The Corps engineers pays for the issue. So it's between the Corps and ODFW. But it's been 35 years and nothing's been done. I have no faith anything is going to be done, you know. And so we got basically four hatchery fish, we need to get those numbers to the mitigation, where they went around to town hall after town hall after town hall, and promised everybody they would keep the fisheries as healthy and viable as they were prior to the dam being put in. It's in statute, in, you know, the authorization document for Lost Creek Dam to mitigate for the losses in behind the dam. Nobody's holding their feet to the fire. And I think this isn't, I would like to, personally, I would like to see a bill that directed them to their mitigation goals to get those done. And it's not doing anything to ODFW, it's giving them something to stand on, you know, a basis, you know, where they can work with the Corps, get the funding, get the job done on the hatchery fish that need to be mitigated for. Outside of that, we had Representative Esquivel, you know, mentioned Big Butte Creek, which is a kind of a passion of mine. I know it, you know, intimately, you know, all the way through. There is warm water in Big Butte Creek, but only below the diversion. There's 100 cubic feet plus diversion up, I'm going to say, 7 or 8 miles up Big Butte Creek, and they have the right to take virtually all the water in the creek. And historically, there was about 225 cubic feet a second, you know, come down Big Butte Creek. And now in the summertime, there's 30 to 40. And that's why it's, you know, warm. But if we took adult wild spring snook and put them into the area above the diversions, the water's cold, it's pristine, it looks great, you know. And we've had quite a bit of comment about that in our task force meetings, and it was decided that, you know, we shouldn't do that. Don't have to have water to truck them up there. Have to have water for them to make it there on their own, you know. But they can go up there, spawn, be healthy, happy, smolt can rear like they would. The conditions are nearly identical of what they were above the dam before it was put in. You know, water temperatures and life cycles. Put them up there, let them, you know, do their thing. The smolt can go out to the ocean. The next year you'd have to truck, you know, more back up. But it's not that far, you know, and I can't see it being that expensive. And they do capture them at the hatchery because they swim into the hatchery. And it also creates a spot where you will always have wild spring snook no matter what happens over in the main stem. You're preserving the population. But I would like to see the Hatchery Research Center look at the area above Butte Falls and where it's pristine out there, and look at it and have them ascertain whether there is a problem with competition between the steelhead and the coho that spawn up there in the native fish, you know, and what kind of levels that they think that it could hold, if any, you know. And then we'd have the science on it rather than just saying, well, we can't do it because the water's up there. We can't do it because we don't have money to move the fish up there. You know, we can't do it because they weren't there, used to be there, you know. Well, there didn't used to be a dam either, you know. And things have changed. We need to move ahead. And but basically two things. We got to expand habitat, and we've got to get the mitigation goals back to where they should have been, you know, and where we were promised. No, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Witt. My name's Denny Hewson, and I've been a licensed fishing guide on the Rogue River since 1966, and I've seen a lot of changes. Like Steve said, the dam hasn't been all bad, but it certainly has changed a lot of things. I'm just very concerned for the fisheries. One of the things the dam has changed, besides the loss of spawning habitat, is when we used to start our Rogue River Canyon trips at Grants Pass and go clear to Agnes, we never saw fall chinooks in the river until usually late September and early October. Now the fall salmon are going up in early August because of the higher water flow is being released from the dam. So they go right up there and compete for what little bit of spawning habitat's left with the spring salmon. And this is not acceptable. So I did attend all the meetings back in the 70s before they put the dam in, and heard all the promises about how they were going to give us mitigation for the lost spawning habitat. So I really think that they need to stand up to what they said they would do. I'm not going to read all this. You have a copy of it, but 87.4% of my clients came from out of state over the last 50 years. And they spent with me anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000 a day when you take into consideration the motels, the restaurants, the fishing tackle, the licenses. All this is being lost. A lot of them are going to go to Alaska now to fish, British Columbia, out of our country, and even Russia. We're losing this income, and it's sad. I mean, I made a living for 50 years. I paid my property taxes, my state and federal income taxes. I put money back into the community. I employed people. I just hope that we can find an answer to this problem that we have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions? Vice Chair Krieger.
I guess it was, 20 years ago you and I had the letter about gravel recruitment?
22.
And nothing's been done. And I don't know if the people understand what happens, but when no gravel comes down the river, what's there could move through the system. So if you look at the number of great big boulders that are in there, at one time there was gravel all through there and fish spawned. So obviously we've had a huge loss of that. I want the department to come back to us with some type of evaluation. It doesn't have to be a five-year study, but hey, what's changed? What do we need to do? Obviously, you could take two guys and go up there and sit down and look at it, and I don't think it's going to take a scientist to tell us what we need to do. And you're going to get volunteers, you're going to get gravel, you're going to get money. So that to me is an easy one. The whole thing about the lower river, they actually had people walk across Rogue River Bay without getting their knees wet a couple of summers ago in a low tide. That's ridiculous. Like, remember when I got there in 64, how much deep water there was, the fact that there was eelgrass and there was a good habitat for fish, that's gone. If you were to have a flood today, like we had even in 96, the water level would be so much higher and it'd be inundated a lot more property, cause damage. Now, Cam Perry, who's the chair of the Salmon Research Center, has a company that does massive programs. They've done them all over the world. We're putting a work group together in Gold Beach, and you're going to be honest, Steve. ODFW, we want someone from ODFW there. NOAA has furnished a person for us out of the Southern District, not out of Seattle, who's very pro what we need to do there. People always say, you don't have to do another study. Well, in order to show the need and the exact science of what needs to happen, you're going to have to take the time to do a scientific inquiry as to what type of a project you need to do to restore the lower river. They've done a lot of preliminary work already, but probably sometime in the next couple of weeks, I'll be getting hold of Department of Fish and Wildlife and you, Steve, and some others about who needs to be present at this original work group to start addressing the issue of the bay, the lower river, the lack of habitat, and the excessive predation that takes place in the lower river because of its condition. So there are some things moving, but it's so slow, and every one of you guys is someplace in your 60s toward 70. When we have less time, we value the time more. I want to get it done, some of these things, during my lifetime to see that we actually made a difference.
Vice Chair McLean.
I just wanted to thank all three of you gentlemen for your comments today. I really appreciated the department's comments and the history, because I'm not as familiar as some of you are with that area or with fishing. But I do believe that what we heard today was over 100 years worth of ground truthing. And I think, to my point a little bit earlier, we need those studies. We need independent science information, but we also need the reality of what's on the ground and what we can see personally happening with our own eyes. And so I really appreciate the comments that you brought to the table today, and I really appreciate the fact that we had a full discussion. I want to thank the chair for that, because we got both the department's, you know, history and what they're trying to do and what they're seeing and what the science is pointing them toward. But we're also getting pragmatic expertise on the ground of people who are using the river, who have used the river, and who have, you know, have some ideas of some solutions that hopefully we can take some advantage of, because it's their business. It's their, you know, maybe it's a hobby and a business, but it is definitely an area that you have much in the way of background and experience. So thank you very much for the comments you brought to this committee. And I know this chair and many of the folks who have sat on this committee for years have really a desire, a passion, and really want to see, you know, some action. And so hopefully we can bring some of that discussion to the next session. So thank you very, very much.
Additional questions or comments? Gentlemen, I picked up on three key factors here that you're attributing low salmon production, low water predation, and gravel recruitment. I don't know if there are others that you want to add to that list, but can you explain to me why it is that this appears to be a factor for hatchery-produced fish and not so much for wild fish? Is it a matter of timing the year that we return to the ocean? Is that what's driving this, or can you help me get past that?
The wild fish are migrating downstream while the water is relatively on the cooler side of
So temperature is another factor.
Okay, so the water temperature has a factor. The other thing, the hatchery fish are released when the water temperature is at its highest. The predation is at its highest.
Yeah.
And if you look at the graph that ODF&W put up there, and you see the sharp decrease that we've seen in the last several years, and I'll contend that the feeding of pike minnows, $1.5 million worth of juveniles for the last several years, has increased and done very well to produce more and larger pike minnows, and those are mostly the reason why the hatchery juveniles are not getting to the lower river. We are putting them into the river, and they are being eaten before they get to the bay.
Uh-huh.
And ODF&W hasn't faced that. They don't want to face it. They don't want to truck the fish downriver because they figure they're going to stray. They won't come back upriver, and that's not true. Those fish will come right back to the hatchery if you truck them downriver and let them go. And they won't be eaten by the pike minnows because the pike minnows are largely above Lobster Creek Bridge.
Let me ask a related question. Were we to manipulate that release time, do we then run on the backside problems with hatchery-raised fish co-spawning with the wild fish? What downside is there to potentially altering the timing of the release?
One of the big things that the conservation plan has done and has been very successful at doing, which surprised me, you know, and might have surprised us all, is that it has reduced the number of hatchery fish spawning with wild fish. Mm-hmm. This last year, we had one of the bigger returns we've had in a number of years at 15,800 wild fish, and there was only 2% or less hatchery fish found on the spawning beds, because they really honed back the hatchery well. A number of years ago, I'm going to say, well, I kind of lose track, but I'm going to say about 15 years ago, they did a net pen project downstream about 20 miles below the dam to try and keep the hatchery fish down where the fishermen could catch them rather than swim right back up into the hatchery. And so I'm not sure how long they acclimated them in net pen and fed them there, but it was a month and a half or better, you know. And the project didn't work. The fish, they tagged them, and they swam right back to the hatchery, you know. So by releasing these smolt at different times, they're already imprinted to the concrete in the hatchery and whatnot, and I think they'll come back in good numbers. We also are far below our status of 15% hatchery fish on the spawning beds the conservation plan calls for. We're 2% or less this last year. Over the last 5 years, we've been under 5% on average, you know. And I don't think the risk is there, you know, when we have that much room to work with.
One other point to that, too, is that the wild...
Sir, would you please identify yourself? Because
yes.
For the record, we don't know who's speaking yes. 10 years down the road.
Rick Howard, thank you.
Thank you.
Another point to that is that the fish, the adults that actually swim into the hatchery, there's enough wild fish that actually swim into the hatchery that the majority of the brood that are used for the egg taking are all from wild fish. Mm. Okay, so very small contingent of actual hatchery fish are used in the hatchery program.
I see.
So they're one generation removed if they spawn in the wild. And if you can tell me that that's genetically not familiar or similar, you know, it's crazy.
Vice Chair Krieger, you said that you have a group that will be meeting on this issue?
On some of these issues, especially the estuary issue.
And that will begin when?
Probably about 2 weeks.
And that will include the department as well?
Yep. We'll ask someone from the department, maybe the Corps, Watershed Council, our extension agent. I'll probably want Steve, and that group will get together and say, okay, who are we missing? What other type of person do we need here? Because you probably need to have someone from the environmental committee who might object to it to start with. As long as they're there to hear the whole story and the reasoning, they're much, much better having those people as part of the group than to exclude them, because they might not disagree, you know, they might not agree with you. We don't know yet what the science might tell us we have to do.
Well, I want to affirm Vice Chair McLean's earlier statement that I am fully in favor of robust fisheries, but I am also exceedingly reluctant and would likely be opposed to legislating fisheries and biological management. But what we've heard here today is troubling. And I would hope that all of the parties of interest and concern can come together and find a pathway forward. Because if I were to believe and trust the slides that we were presented here, much as Representative Esquivel was pointing out, it simply ain't working. Now, that doesn't mean that simple answers are the fix. I am very wary and cautious about simple fixes. And it's not to suggest that what you all have suggested and presented here today are by any means simple. They're not. Gravel recruitment's going to be a major project in and of itself. But before we move forward with any kind of intervention here by the legislature, I want to make absolutely certain that we are on solid ground. I don't want to continue with the kind of slides that we saw where there is no production at all. And I'm not sure that there's a heck of a lot of hope for the future. That's not where I want to go. But I am very cautious of the simple fix. And Representative Krieger, I am going to rely on you and the group that you pull together to inform this committee and keep us informed on a regular basis.
For how long?
Well,
I haven't got long.
You've got plenty long enough, Representative, and so that we can hopefully begin to turn things around here on a solid scientifically valid basis. Yes, sir.
I would like to ask Russ Stoff to make contact with me and Ed. I think there's some things we can do. We don't need legislation. Maybe some dollars needed someplace, but sometimes that can happen too. We can address some of these issues.
Well, good plans with compelling scientific reason may be the first step at getting dollars if they're necessary. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that I think this comes back to what we discussed and never really jumped on or put our arms around when it comes to a budgeting process, that you need to start with $0. You need to have a goal and to see if that's attainable. And all parties agree that it's attainable, then go ahead. If it costs money, it costs money, but it has to meet the goal. And I think that I think of this, I think of the sage grouse, I think of the, all the things that we've discussed in this committee. And if we had goals out there and saying, okay, you have to attain this within a certain period of time, then I think it would get done. But example, I don't know where we're even at. We talked about predators here. Where are we at on our predator program? I have no idea. They're supposed to come back in September and talk to us about it, but I'm not sure where we're at.
Well, one thing I do want to be sure of, it meets that criteria, Representative, and secondly, that we are on solid, sound, scientific footing
based
when you
on
come
fact.
Back. So, Vice Chair McLean.
I just want to make one comment, because I don't think we have to be for science or against science. I am not for or against science. I want science to be part of the mix, and I do want it to be foundational. But we had our own department say we don't have the money to do some of the work that you've asked us questions about here today. And so if we want to have a foundation on science, then we have to make sure they have the budget to do the full completed package, and that means answering questions, and that means giving budget, to that research. So, again, please, I am not for or against science. I'm not for or against ground truthing. I am for having all facts, and I want them to be, to make
correct.
Sure that those facts are complete and that we're not, that we're not using, empirical data takes time, research, and money. And so if we're going to make sure that we're using a foundation of science and we're also using the reality of ground truthing, then we have to do the budgeting to make it happen. I'm very encouraged that Representative, you who have been here longer than I, so more than most of you have been here longer than I, but the whole idea, we can do things without legislation. Let's do it. Let's go forward with that. Let's be part of that. If there is some legislation that really has to happen to get to what you say is the best, place to be, whether it be because we want so many fish going down the river in a given amount of time or at a specific amount of time, then let's figure that out. But I agree with you that many of the updates that we've had today has to do with giving enough budget and secure budget that the department can do their work.
Yes.
And having people in our public not feel frustrated with sitting around waiting for that work to happen. So.
And the public being equally frustrated that it has every appearance that we do nothing and we're just slipping further and further back. So,
Mr. Chair, what we do is we get into that downward cycle of people get frustrated, there's nothing to fish or hunt, so they quit buying license, which in turn ODF&W has a shortfall and they want to raise the fees, which in turn drops off the number of people that hunt and fish, and it's just a vicious cycle and no one's figured it out. But it's something that we need to approach, and we need to have some very frank discussions about having 400 and some biologists, and what's the outcome? What do they do?
Well, I will be informed by the group. I will be informed by the department. My door is open. My phone is available. and I want this thing turned around. Anything further?
One other thing.
Yes.
I'm taking the representative turkey hunting this week, and I'm supposed to go down and tie one up for him because he's not that good of a shot.
Oh, stake through the heart. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your appearance
you.
Here today and all the very important information that you brought forward. With that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Rogue Spring Chinook Conservation Plan. Is there anything that concludes our committee's business? Is there anything for the good of the order?
Good job, Mr. Chair.
Good job.
With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you all very, very much. Adjourned. Thank you all very, very much.
Information.
We stand.